Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to talk to Pennsylvania State Representative Pat Harkin about the unemployment situation. You know, again, it boggles the mind that there's this money out there that the feds have said here, use this to help your long-term unemployed, help the folks in your community, help your small businesses. Yet we've got Republicans here in the state of Pennsylvania who the only thing they seem to think are important are, well, we need to define marriage between a man and a woman, and we need to have some voter stuff, and we need to have put out a voter of a birther bill. What the heck is wrong with these people? I mean, at some point, don't they have to live up to what they claimed during the campaign, that it was about the jobs? Yet nothing I've seen come out of the Pennsylvania House or the Senate has led me to believe that the Republicans are interested in anything having to do with creating jobs. Now, they've done a really, really good job of tearing down government, of going after people who are making a reasonable wage. Doing a great job of that, man. But when it comes to actually creating something, not so much. And, you know, as I've said, you know, 1,000 times, anybody can tear a house down. You can give a 2-year-old a hammer, and they'll do a pretty good job of tearing a house apart. It takes somebody who is skilled, someone who is caring, someone who gives a rat's behind to actually build a house, actually build something. But all we're seeing out of the Republicans right now is tearing things down. Tearing it down without regard for the day after tomorrow. And again, it's all this divisive stuff right back again, because they've got no idea what they're doing. None whatsoever. They have no vision for this country. They have no plan on how to get us out of the problems that we're in. They've got nothing. All they've got is the failed past. All of those nice talking points that they ran out in the past that have all failed. That's all they've got. So what do? They go back to dividing. So we end up with birther bills, and we end up with abortion again and gay marriage again and all of these nonsensical issues in the big picture. I mean, they're important to small segments of the population, but in the big picture, which is jobs, which is an economy that works for everyone, that creates a middle class. But what do the Republicans do? Going back after abortion again. And in the second hour, we're going to talk with Amanda Marcotte. You know, one of her things is this issue. And personally, I understand it. I wish we didn't have to have abortions. I wish we had an economy where people wanted to bring children into this country, into this world. The problem is we just don't. Not right now. Also in the second hour, Henry Jasny, advocate for highway and auto safety, can you hear me talking about the truck limits, as well as Todd Spencer, executive director, vice president of the Owner Operators Independent Drivers Association. Because I think this is a pretty big issue. The fact that they want to put more on these trucks, more weight, which, you know, in the wintertime, probably going to be a lot worse. Our infrastructure is already crumbling, going to be a lot worse. But, you know, business gets what business wants. And if they want 100,000 pounds on a truck, that's what they're going to get. If they want this, and really, at the end of it, it's about cutting costs. It's about cutting labor costs. It's about cutting drivers. It's about cutting workers. That's what it's really about. And don't let them give you any nonsense otherwise. That is what it is. So we'll be talking about that. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Today, the big news was the president went to Ground Zero. He laid a wreath at the site there at Ground Zero and met with the families who lost loved ones. He met with people who worked on the pile, private meetings with the families. I thought it was a very, very good thing. I thought it was respectful. The right losing their mind still. They still haven't gotten the talking points down on how to tear down him going after Bin Laden, but they're going to tear everything else apart, especially this. Now, he did everything that he could do to make this a nonpartisan. He invited Giuliani, he invited Bloomberg, he invited Bush, and Bush didn't want to go. And what we hear out of the right is, well, he's not doing enough to share the glory. I'm sorry, I don't know how much more you need to reach out. They reached out to Bush, and he got nothing. But anyway, they went there today, and they had the ceremony, which I thought was a good thing. All along, I think he's done the right thing. And the news reports coming out, and the right's doing everything they can possibly do to somehow muddle this. And, you know, I look at this group, one of these conservative legal watchdog groups. I'm not even going to give their name, but they're now filing a lawsuit because they want, under the Freedom of Information Act, because they believe the photos. They believe that those have to be put into the public domain. And my thought of this is, you know, don't they really have anything else to do? I mean, really, I really don't think that this is a good thing to have happen. I understand transparency. I understand all of that. But there are some times when you look at the national good and you say, you know, this is something that is going to, I think, harm us down the road. And this group, honestly, they're just looking for publicity. They're trying to get their, you know, their street cred with the conservatives so they can dig into their pockets. It's about money. We know that. But at the end of it, I think the president has done the right thing, and I hope these photos don't come out. I just think it's a bad idea, and I wish these people would have something better to do. So that's my point on that. And a lot of these stories. You know, I'm generally someone who's open to the, we have to have open, transparent government, but this, it's a little more sensitive than just, hey, here's some photos. And I think what it is most of my friends on the right, they're the type of people who, they like rubbing your nose in it. They're the ones who want the excessive celebration in the end zone, and I do too. When it's football, I don't care about that. But when you're talking about this, where there are a billion plus people who you really don't want to tick off anymore, because do we really want to fight this perpetually? Do we want to go back to the days of the Crusades, even though Bush himself said, you know, just like the Crusades? You remember that, Jake, the whole Crusade comment?
Yeah, that, yes, I do.
And I don't know that we want to go back to those days. So why not have a little compassion, a little sympathy for someone else, thought of someone else before ourselves. Your thoughts?
Well, I hear these right wingers calling into all the talk shows, and their philosophy is, well, they're going to hate us anyway. Well, To some degree, I agree with that. However,
the fives are going to hate us.
However, why put gasoline on the fire? Why give them added ammunition? Why enable them to use him more of a martyr than they're going to? I just think it serves no useful purpose. I mean, to what end do we need to see these? I mean, are we really, do these right-wing groups really doubt that he was killed?
There should be no question. That's part of it. I think that's part of it. But I think the other part of it is they want to inflame the Muslim community. They want to rub their noses in it. They want that conflict. They need it. They want that. Because that's how they can continue to scare people. Now that Lex Luthor is gone, now that the boogeyman is gone, there's no need for a superhero right now. Now that the people that you were, the person you were able to scare people with, now that that's gone, they need to get someone else. And all I kept hearing is, well, you know, Obama, all he wanted to do, you know, up until this point was put Khalid Sheikh Mohammed up on trial in New York. Which I got to be honest with, I was in favor of. And why? Because I think around the world, you say, this is who we are. We believe in the rule of law. We're going to find him guilty. There's enough evidence to find him guilty. And you put that on display. But there are those who, you know, who evidently don't believe in the rule of law and don't believe in our system. And that's what it comes down to. If those who weren't in favor of that trial, basically what they're saying is, we don't believe our system's capable of doing this. We don't believe that the system that we have is capable of justice. And if that's the case, we got some real problems. Anyway, today is the anniversary. 50 years ago today, the first American in space, Alan Shepard, who is famous for the Shepard Prayer, which I quote often, oh, Lord, don't let me screw this up, which I think is funny. but he today was the first American in space. The flight lasted about 15 minutes to get up into the suborbital flight, 116 miles into the air. Pretty amazing stuff. And, you know, it led us to that whole, eventually we made it to the moon, and he was the fifth man to stand on the moon. So, you know, I look at that and I go, you know, I don't know that we were any less divided. I don't know that people had any less divisions, if you will, but they were able to come together to do that. Why can't we come together and do the things that we need to do? Like, oh, I don't know, make sure the unemployed have help. Which is when we come back, we're going to talk with Patrick Harkin, state representative, about this unemployment bill that Perry's put out, which is just horrible and destructive, but also the May 20th date where the federal money disappears. And all of those people who are dependent on that and need that help, well, they're going to be kicked to the curb. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Patrick Harkins. Back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. 500 Rite Aid workers took every anti-union tactic and trick that the giant company could throw at them, and after a five-year struggle, they're proud members of the ILWU with their first contract. International Longshore and Warehouse Union spokesman Craig Merrilies.
It took a long time because the company decided to launch an all-out anti-union attack. The remarkable thing is that the workers stood together, fought back, were not intimidated, and despite firings, threats, and and other forms of coercion, they stuck together, hung in there, and were able to continue to take action on the shop floor and motivate thousands of community supporters in California and around the country to support them.
So much for the suggestion that if voters actually knew how much Social Security and Medicare contributed to the budget, they'd be willing to cut it. Jesse Russell reports.
A new poll out by Quinnipiac University has some clarifying numbers as we enter the long 2012 election season. Voters overwhelmingly like Medicare. 70% of those polled and told that Medicare was a major part of the federal budget said they were against limiting the program. 72% were against limiting Social Security. However, when the same question was asked for defense funding, 54% of voters polled supported cutting that part of the budget. In a statement, Quinnipiac Polling Assistant Director Peter Brown said his organization wanted to see if voters responded differently if it was made clear how much of the budget those three issues comprised. Voters also told the firm by a margin of 69% to 28%. They support raising taxes for households earning $250,000 or more. Quinnipiac also asked voters how enthusiastic they are regarding the current lineup of Republican presidential candidate potentials. Mitt Romney and Sarah Palin had the highest enthusiasm level, tying with 15%.
The Economic Policy Institute says that as of 2010, the North American Free Trade Agreement had displaced 682,900 U.S. jobs. A new report from EPI says that when NAFTA was proposed, supporters predicted that it would create hundreds of thousands of jobs for Americans. That did not happen. Economists at EPI says despite NAFTA costing rather than creating hundreds of thousands of jobs, nearly identical jobs claims are now being made about proposed NAFTA-style trade agreements. EPI says growing trade deficits nearly always lead to job losses, and the pending Korea-U.S. free trade agreement will likely result in growing trade deficits and job losses for the U.S. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.com.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the way it is. Everything's raisin, but the way it is. Yes, I grow sedan raisins. Everything's raisin, but the way it is.
You know, I got the question I've got, and, you know, during the election, during the run-up to the election last November, all we heard was, you know, that the Republicans were going to be the party of the paycheck, and the Democrats, they were the party of welfare checks. Remember that? Do you remember that, that whole paycheck thing? And then the jobs, 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 jobs. Everything was about jobs. As soon as the election was over, I don't think I've heard one Republican utter the word job. All I hear is divisiveness. And, you know, this week you had Daryl Metcalf who introduced his constitutional amendment because marriage should be between one man and one woman. I don't know how that creates any jobs. His birther bill, not quite sure how that creates a job. This voting restriction bill that he's put out, not quite sure how that's going to create many jobs. But I got to be honest, he is a good Republican. He is following the divisive policies that they keep pushing out there. No jobs, but a lot of divisiveness, a lot of polarization. And I guess that's going to do it. Hey, look at Scott Perry, who's put out this House Bill 916, another destructive piece of legislation to destroy our unemployment compensation system. Again, right in line with the Heritage Foundation, right in line with those think tanks in D.C. In fact, you know, this guy, he said, you know what? You're right. The Chamber of Commerce basically wrote my bill. Amazing stuff. Anyway, I've got Pennsylvania State Representative Pat Harkins on the phone. Pat, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me this evening.
You know, I'm looking at this piece of legislation that Scott Perry put out, House Bill 916, his unemployment bill. And he writes right in his press release that it was written with direct input from the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry and the National Federation of Independent Businesses. Not one mention of any working person's group, nothing. It's all about the business.
And I like Representative Perry. He's a good friend of mine, and I have a lot of respect for him. He's got a strong military background, and he's done a lot of service for his country. But I think he's got this one wrong. I don't see anything in there that helps any working person. And to me, it always seems like the deck is always stacked against the worker, and this just carries it one step further.
You know, this idea that, and a lot of it sounds very nice and very simplistic, but the reality is there are five people out there searching for every one job if it's available. We have a jobs problem. So why is it that all we keep hearing coming out of the Republican-controlled legislature is this divisiveness, the birther bills, the voting bills, all this stuff?
And I just reminded a couple of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle the other day, Tuesday, after the rally out in front of the Capitol. We had 6,000-plus people there. It was great to see the enthusiasm and the drive in people, but I just hope that carries over to Election Day when it means something.
Absolutely.
But I tell people, when I was employed with UPS, I was a driver, and I've lived many of these issues. Unemployment compensation, luckily I didn't have to go through the peaks and valleys that many people do, but I knew people, I interacted every day with people that were up against it sometimes, and like I said, the deck always seemed to be stacked against the worker, and you always had to prove that you were in the right.
And that seems to be the way that this bill is going to be taking things, putting the burden on the back of the worker when it they're already burdened enough at the time when they've lost their job.
Yeah, it eliminates unemployment compensation, makes it financially the eligibility for it more difficult, puts unequal duties on the unemployed to work with people like those at CareerLink, and no requirements are in place for employers to post open jobs with somebody like CareerLink.
And, you know, when I look at this, you know, he talks about savings in his press release. There's going to be a boatload of savings. We're going to save a lot of money. Those savings that he's claiming, as I understand it, maybe I'm wrong here, but those are reduced benefits. Those are restricting eligibility for people, so kicking people off the rolls, and then restricting eligibility for people who have to reapply, again, keeping people off of it.
And if it's things like telephone hearings on demand. I know when I was at UPS, we had a grievance procedure, very slow, very cumbersome. It wasn't in favor of the worker. It was in favor of the company. The worker would have to take off work and go and prove that they weren't doing what the company claimed they were. It's a situation where the worker has to prove himself. Think of what we could accomplish if we didn't have to monkey around with these kind of things. If you could let the worker be the worker and do what they're supposed to do and not have the interference, even in the legislature, if we could work on producing jobs instead of privatizing schools, selling liquor stores and everything else, we could create jobs. We could create an atmosphere. I know they don't like to say they create jobs or we create jobs, but they could set up the situation so we do have a level playing field and make it about working people and jobs and make everybody happy. I just reminded somebody the other day about when Bill Clinton was president. The wealthy were making money. The poor and the middle class were working, and they were doing things and producing, and everybody seemed pretty good. We weren't at war. We had a pretty good economy, and I liked the way things were back then, and I hope someday we can get back to that.
Yeah, well, I hope we can get back to a time when the economy is spiraling upward and we have policy that encourages expansion instead of what we keep hearing out of Washington and here in Harrisburg, which is continuing this spiraling down and this constriction of policy that makes it harder and harder to expand.
We've become so polarized in politics, it's not good for anyone.
Because, you know, all I keep hearing out of both Washington and here in Harrisburg is we need to cut, we need to cut, we need to cut, we need to slash this, slash that. When the reality is, and I firmly believe this, we have a revenue problem more than we have a spending problem.
I agree. And I always like the cliches they have. And when you think them through, they talk about spending money like a family. If your family had a family member who was sick and in the hospital, would you cut that coverage for that person and say, bye-bye, sorry, we can't help you out? Or would you go take out a loan and do what the moral and ethical thing is to do? I know I would do that for my family.
Yeah.
And a lot of these people must come from dysfunctional families that they preach the things that they do.
Boy, that is an excellent point. I'm going to steal that.
If
you don't mind, because, you know, I hear this talk all the time about we have to go back to how we do things at the kitchen table, and it drives me nuts. Because, you know, when times are tough for me, you know, I tighten my belt a little bit, but there's some things you can't go back on. You got to pay your mortgage. You got to pay the light bills.
Sure.
You eat mac and cheese every once in a while. But you also go out and you make more money. You increase your revenue as well.
And when has your utilities ever gone down? I always tell everybody it's a great thing to think that someday you're going to get caught up with everything. But like I said before, I have three children, and you just never my wife and I always try to cut and conserve where we can, but you never can come up with a solution sometimes to tuition payments and, you know, everything else that you need to do with your utilities and insurance payments and everything else. It's a tough racket for everybody.
Yeah, I understand. Let me ask you this. May 20th is just around the corner. We're days away. I have yet to see anything coming out of here in Harrisburg that leads me to believe anything's going to get done on getting the federal money for extending unemployment benefits. Do you have any experience? What's going on here?
I don't, and I haven't heard anything, and I don't have a whole lot of faith in the administration. I think back to last summer when Governor Corbett was then candidate Corbett, and he was saying that everybody on unemployment chose to be on there. It would be laughable if it wasn't so serious and if these people's lives weren't at stake and so much was on the line for them. These things seem to get pushed to the side, though. Like I said before, they take a backseat to the governor pushing his agenda on school vouchers and privatizing the liquor store.
Let's talk about vouchers for a second. The governor is on Monday going to be in Washington, D.C., sharing the stage with Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin. I don't know that that's a great move, but, you know, that just shows how in favor he is of destroying public education, in my opinion. And for anybody who wants to go to protest outside of the place, contact me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. We'll make sure that we arrange some transportation to D.C. For the afternoon. But, you know, I'm looking at this, and I think it's a huge issue that I don't think has gotten enough discussion of the negative sides of this. Everyone likes the idea, oh, we're gonna have some bizarre level of choice. But I liken it to having a winning lottery ticket with nowhere to validate it.
And everybody thinks they hear voucher, they think it's free money. I always say that voucher people want to remove the public from public education. And to me, our most important duty in society is to educate our children. But it's all about the money. Follow the money, as they say. Philadelphia has 114 charter schools, and my area has 3 up in Erie. We wouldn't benefit from this because we're not a failing school district. We have financial difficulties like you can't believe, but no one here would benefit from it. Our taxes would go up. The projection is $1 billion to start this program. And I look at an area like Dubois that's a rural area. They wouldn't derive any gain education-wise from this, yet their taxes would go up. What's the incentive for those people to push for Senate Bill 1 or something like that?
Yeah, I'm right there with you. But at the end of this, it comes back to this frame that's been pushed time and time again that private is always better. Somehow, if we privatize the schools, all those problems will go away. If we allow private for-profit interests to take over, everything will be wonderful. And I've yet to see hard data on that. The charter schools that I have seen, they don't perform that much better, even though they get the pick of the litter.
And they're not held accountable to the same standards as public education is. And I also remind my friends in Catholic schools that if you take the money, you take the problem. If you take a student who has dyslexia, for example, that school then has to hire an expert, where now many of those students from the Catholic school would be sent to an intermediate unit or a teacher with experience in that background would come into the building and work with that student, but they're setting themselves up for a huge financial hit, as well as taking the students that they normally would be able to say no to, disruptive problem students.
What do you think the chances of this thing passing?
I don't see it going. I think there's some level-headed Republicans that are opposed to it. I don't think the votes are there, and I think that's why it keeps getting put off from week to week. But they're going to try and sweeten the deal, and as they do that, they have to keep adding money to it, and so once the taxpayer sees it's not financially a wise proposition, they will oppose it, I believe.
I mean, because if you're willing to spend $1 billion to start this up, why don't we spend that $1 billion on what we've already got in place?
Well, I'll point out, I went against my leadership on the Education Committee last week, and I voted to enhance the qualities of the earned income tax credit. I think that's a win-win for the business community who we want to push to get involved in a lot of these endeavors, as well as the student and the school. There were 3 of us at the Education Committee that went along with the Republicans on that. I think that's a program that's in place that we could work with. But even there, I had some reservations because Corbett's taken money away from public education, but we're putting it into private. Like I said, I have 3 kids in private school, and I pay the tuition, and I make the sacrifice for that, but we shouldn't take away from public education.
And that's what worries me. Somewhere down the line, when we're looking at You know, I went to public high school. I know a lot of people who went through public school. Their parents could never afford, even with the most, the most drastic of sacrifice. Mm-hmm. They could have never afforded to send their kids to school, to private school. I worry that we end up with a situation where if you can't afford it, you don't go.
It becomes education for the wealthy.
And that's what worries me. We're going to go back 100 years, and I say often that the Republicans, the hardcore, the far right, wants to repeal the entire 20th century and take us back to the good old days of the 1880s, and that appears to be more and more the case.
And like I say, the National Republican Party seems to have been hijacked by the religious right and the extreme right, and I see it coming into even local races, even up in our area in some respects. Questions about sexual orientation and things like that. I didn't run on social issues. I am a pro-life Democrat. I'm like Bob Casey, pretty fiscal conservative when it comes to money. But I see the benefit of a lot of these programs, and I don't want to see us go back, like you said, 100 years. We've come so far under Rendell with a lot of the educational initiatives that he's put in place and the people he had with him. To see the hits that Corbett wants to give Dyer-Ed, it gives me a sick feeling in my stomach.
And the other part of that is when you're talking about, especially about higher ed, is if you want to attract businesses, how are you going to do that with an uneducated workforce?
Yeah, that and look at the other states who have colleges that we compete with, and we compete to have students come here. California, Ohio, we should be doing all we can to enhance every aspect of higher ed. Instead, these people seem to want to tear it down, and I don't see what the motive is for that. I mean, a lot of them have gone through the system. They've used it, and my dad always said, be leery of people who use the ladder and then pull it up once they're up on the roof.
Excellent point. For me, though, Representative, is I have this belief that the far right wants to privatize everything. We keep hearing this core function of government, and I really don't think they think education is a core function of government. I don't think that they believe that, you know, we should have private police. We should, like, go back to the good old days, private police, private fire, private education, for those who can afford it.
And with all due respect, and I do mean all due respect, some of these members are in their early 20s, and I don't think they fully comprehend the significance of education on any level. Some of them, I think, just got out of the schools and maybe have some axe to grind or something, but it's frustrating to see where they're coming from and their philosophical view on education. To me, there's not much there.
Yeah, it's nice if you were born with a silver spoon in your mouth. Wish that would have happened to me.
Right, me too.
But the reality is I have seen how difficult it has been to get through school and to get through college and pay the loans, and seeing massive cuts like this and saddling our future generation with even larger student debt, to me is just not. Not the way to move this country forward. Last question I've got, you know, this May 20th date stuck in my head because there are several people we know that are long-term unemployed, and they're really sweating this out because there's nothing out there for them. Do you think anything? And what can we do to try and get something done before May 20th?
And on every issue, I spent most of my day today talking with teachers who are concerned with the cuts that are coming down the pike, as well as DPW people who have issues with the spending cap and things like that. And I'm pointing out, too, to people, there is $1 billion supposedly that's been found in the new numbers that have been released. We just learned that as we were leaving Harrisburg yesterday. Unanticipated revenue is up close to $1 billion. And I just heard that the governor wants to create a rainy day fund. I said to the news people in Harrisburg when I was leaving the Capitol, it's raining cats and dogs up in my area. And while I do believe in spending and having reserves and everything else, we're at no point right now when we're talking about cutting things that are essential to the public. We should maybe look down the road a few years. Maybe we can set up a rainy day fund. But it's too much. There's too much storms on the horizon right now to go that way. But I would hope that the governor would come to his senses. I would hope that some of the people on the other side of the aisle would realize that, you know, these people are out of work. They vote. They're in their districts. Listen to them.
At least I hope they vote.
Yeah. I get the sense that a lot of people are going to start voting now.
I sure hope so. Representative Harkins, I appreciate your time. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you. I could go on for hours, but I'll let you go. I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks so much. Look forward to having you back again real soon.
Thanks again.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is why we fight, why we violate. This is why we fight.
Finally, radio for the rest of us. Rick Smith.
Nuclear power boys are weaseling again, this time in Vermont. Entergy Corporation, an electric utility giant based in New Orleans, owns the Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Plant, which is nearing the end of its 40-year license to operate. No problem. Here's a 20-year extension of your license, said the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission, a notorious industry lapdog. But wait, said Vermont officials. Entergy signed an agreement with us to seek state approval for continuing to operate the 40-year-old reactor. And our legislature has decided, in a word, no. So the corporation has gone running to federal court to weasel out of its state agreement, arguing that federal authority takes precedent over locals on nuclear matters. Entergy insists that decisions made by Vermont's legislature are political, whereas the NRC decision to extend the license is made by experts. Besides, says an Entergy executive, Vermont Yankee has gotten good safety and performance ratings from an industry group. So trust us. An industry group? Isn't that like saying your mother thinks you're doing a good job? Curiously, Entergy refuses to release the industry report. Trust us, it says again. No. The Vermont Yankee nuke plant is the same vintage and make as the number one reactor at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi plant. And it has recently had embarrassing operational issues. For example, corporate officials testified to legislators in 2009 that radioactive tritium could not leak into soil and water because the facility had no buried pipes. Trust us, they reiterated. But only a few months later, a tritium leak from an underground pipe was discovered. This is Jim Hightower saying, trust us? Not on our lives. That's why decisions on nuclear power must be political. The people, not experts, must rule.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out. HightowerLowdown.com.
Who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters? Rick Smith.
Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
Yeah, and he hates unemployment. Hates those people on unemployment. Well, listen to our Republican friends. That's basically what it is. Those unemployed, they're lazy. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. May 20th is just around the corner, and there's some federal money out there. There's the ability to make sure that folks make it into the summer months when the jobs situation gonna look a little bit better. But yet we've got representatives who, they don't care about them. It's all about the politics. It's all about their message. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Ike on line one. How you doing tonight, Ike?
Well, I've joined the class of the 99ers, finally.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, and, I look at where McDonald's hired 50,000 people, but they took over 900,000 applications. Meanwhile, I don't know if I'm going to pass a kidney stone or whatever, but I've got blood in the urine. So what do I do with that? I guess, I can't go to the doctor because I have no money. I'm just going to bet that it's a kidney stone. That's the only thing I can do. I'm going to sit here and play Russian roulette with my health. Because, I don't want to be a burden. I know our country can't afford to take care of its own. So I'll just, I don't know. Who knows, man? Maybe I'll die out on the street,
Well,
isn't that the beautiful life we have here in America now? Isn't this great? This is what I hope my kids get to experience.
Well, this is conservative world at its conclusion. This is where we the pay or die healthcare system that we have leaves some 50 some million folks uninsured, such as yourself.
Meanwhile, they extort the virtues of that psychopath and Ayn Rand, who we all know the story of that woman.
Selfishness is good. Greed is good.
These people are sick. They're psychopaths. They're sociopaths. They're just flat out sick. And, I can't say it enough, but I got to tell you, like I said before, I worked in the car industry for Chrysler. After they got their loan guarantee, they put 700 of us out of work. They moved to Mexico. I worked in the steel business. They flooded the market with foreign steel and just decimated the steel business. I went into construction, and now where am I? I've got 15 million or 50 million or God knows how many million illegals that come in here and act like they own my country. They run people over and kill them on the highways. They commit crimes and never go to jail. They go to jail, they bond out, they disappear. They've got carte blanche. They look at us gringos on the construction jobs like you're a fool.
At the end of the day, Ike, it's not about you and them. It's about all of us against the people who have put this situation together.
It still comes down to the same thing. Throw the employers in jail or fine them.
Yes.
Make the fines pay for the enforcement. Get the enforcement, get a real ID that can't be tampered with. E-verify and all the employees. E-verify when you go to rent a house. E-verify when you buy a car. Let's get some law enforcement in here and make this happen. But beyond that, the other part, never lose sight. The rich need to start paying what they should have been paying all along. And I'm telling you, brother, it's getting close to a point where they're going to pay one way or another. And I'll give you a quick example. The grocery store right here, right next to my house.
Right.
I walked in there the other day and they had a sign up on the door said we can't sell any cold products at all. I went in there and all the freezers were down. Well, I walked back in there later on in the afternoon and the manager come up. How you doing? I said, what happened to your cooler? She said, somebody went up on the roof and stole all the copper. And I could tell he was a Republican type dude. And I said, well, that's what happens. You got people can't get a job, can't get unemployment. They're going to eat.
Yep.
And they don't care if they steal your copper. The murders are going up here in Charleston. The armed robberies are going up. People aren't going to sit here and take this crap laying down. If they've got to eat and they got to provide for kids or whatever they got to do, I got to warn these people. I'll tell you right now. The rich can continue down the road they're going, but they obviously have forgotten what happened in the 60s, and they've obviously forgotten what happens to a man when you back him in the corner. And they ought to know better than this, because I don't want to see this kind of crap hit the street, but I'm telling you, bro, it's at a low boil right now, and I'm telling you what, this summer, when it gets hot, I hate to see what's going to happen around this country, boy. It's going to be bad.
Yeah, I'm with you there, Ike. Man, what a horrible situation. But is there anything that are there any social programs? And I know this is a dumb question for South Carolina, but is there anything, any outreach, community health centers, anything like that?
I suppose I could go beg the Christians at the church and, tell them what a godless sinner I am and how I want to be a Jesus freak now if they'll just help me. No, look, I could walk into MUSC down there in the emergency room, but my point is they put me into a position where basically I don't feel like I want to take the abuse and take all the rigmarole and the looks down people's noses and, the judgment from these holier than thou, holy roller, we got our act together and nothing's ever going to happen bad to us. And, just the whole environment, it's sad. And to tell you the truth, as stubborn as I am, I think I'd rather die than put up with their crap, to be honest with you.
I hear you. I wish you the best, brother. I wish you the best.
I'll let you know. And by the way, I'm a tough old bird. It's going to take more than this to put me out. But, but I'm just telling you, if I get to a certain point, all I can tell you is rich folks, beware, because I'm not going out with a whimper. I'm not. I can't see it. these people have been asking for this trouble for a long damn time, and I'm just one of millions out here that are fed up with them.
And I think you're not alone, which is I wish people would take to the streets. I thank you so much, brother. I appreciate it.
Thanks, brother. We'll see.
You know, this is the kind of stuff that, you know, you hear these stories, and this is where I say, you know, folks like this need to, you know, Ike should go to the Capitol, camp out on the front lawn. I'm hoping that this summer we start to see college kids coming to their capitals, unemployed people, especially after May 20th here in the state, when no more extensions, where we start seeing people say, well, I've got nothing left. Here I am. I'm here at your doorstep. That's what it's going to take. It's going to take that kind of a visual, because what we've done a masterful job of in this country is hiding those folks, hiding people like Ike, hiding people like the people that I know who've been kicked off of unemployment already or are about to. We've done a great job of hiding them in the wings. We've done a good job of hiding the unemployed, the uninsured. We've done a really good job of marginalizing them. What I'm saying is they need to get out in the streets and make a little noise. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after the...
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, hiding underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
At PSECU, we know those holiday bills can really pile up and hit you with double-digit interest rates or fees that start to snowball. Next thing you know, you're buried in a mountain of debt. Dig out by using our 3.9 annual percentage rate Visa balance transfer, good through December 31st, 2012. That's a really big deal. And you heard that right. Our really big deal, 3.9% APR, is good through December 31st, 2012. And we don't charge you a balance transfer fee. So if you used any other credit card to pay for your holiday purchases, move those high-interest rate balances to your PSECU Visa. The sooner you get in on this really big deal, the more you'll save. Financing Leg is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/leg to get in on our really big deal Visa balance transfer. Don't wait. Start saving.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell are we fighting for? Just surrender anyone at all. Just got time to say your prayer. While you're waiting for the hammer to fall.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So all we've been hearing about is SEAL Team 6. They've been all the rage this week, and, you know, like most heroes, we do place them on a pedestal, and rightly so. They with precision and accuracy and bravery and courage, they planned out and executed their mission. And we say, you know, we say how much we admire them and how the country needs them, you know, on and on, all that stuff. And I have to wonder what would happen if SEAL Team 6 said, you know what? We've done such a good job, and we live in a country that has a meritocracy. We deserve a raise so we can support our family. After all, this is an elite unit of the Navy SEALs. And yet, as economist Dean Baker points out, ABC News did a feature story about the SEALs to highlight the sacrifices that those enlisted in the unit make. And he writes, in the wake of their successful assault on Osama bin Laden's hideout, ABC News did a short feature on the Navy SEALs. The report tells us that the people who hold this highly demanding and dangerous job get paid about $54,000 a year. He then adds that the base salary, this base salary level for Navy SEALs is comparable to the average salary of a teacher in the U.S. who was somewhere around $55,000 for 2009-2010 school year. That's according to the Digest of Education Statistics. He goes on to point out that this is one possible comparison. What he also says is, why don't we take a look at the CEO class? Why don't we look at the fact that the CEO of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan pocketed around $20 million apiece last year? And, you know, Baker makes an interesting question. You know, why do we look at this through the lens of, well, this is one working person against another? You look at the fact that the average CEO in this country makes about 343 times the average worker, or about 210 times the average SEAL Team 6 member. So for one CEO of a Fortune 500 company, we could have 210 members of SEAL Team number 6. Which do you think is more important? Which do you think is better for the country? A CEO, one smiling, white shirt, tie, bright smile guy, or 210 of the members of SEAL Team 6? Understand, in the 1970s, the average CEO made about 28 times as much as the average worker, or maybe about 20 times as much as a SEAL member, as one of these SEAL Team 6 members. So we put these guys up on a pedestal, and rightly so. So I see this story today. Huffington Post writes, two of the nation's largest mortgage firms illegally forced, forced foreclosure on the homes of almost 50 active duty military service members, according to the Government Accountability Office. The report does not identify the two mortgage companies, but GAO investigators attribute the findings to federal bank regulators who recently completed a three-month probe into the allegations of these improper foreclosures. Now, I was always told that you couldn't do any of that stuff to people who were in the military, who were in active duty, who were fighting a war. You couldn't kick them out of their job. You couldn't kick them out of their house. You couldn't do any of that negative stuff because they're defending the country. They shouldn't have to worry about things at home. They should worry about fighting, doing what they're supposed to do to stay alive so that they can come back. So what we see is this GAO report that says out of 2,800 loans, out of 2,800 that were foreclosed on last year, 50 were these service families. Out of 2,800, 50 of them were military families. I mean, now understand, there were 2.8 million homes foreclosed last year. They sampled 2,800. Out of 2,800, they found 50 of these military families. Out of the 2.8 million, how many do you think were military families? In 2009, nearly 2.9 million residences got a foreclosure notice, according to RealtyTrack. So we go, oh, well, gee, you know, we got to foreclose on those houses. And they're mostly National Guardsmen, you know, people who, you know, signed up because, you know, we're going to help defend the country. They get called up to active duty. They're making less money. Their families back home are struggling to make ends meet. And boom, before you know it, they're out in the street. And you look at the report today that the Forbes 500 list came out. And the fact that, and this is right out of Forbes. The Forbes 500 generated nearly $10.8 trillion in total revenue last year, up 10.5%. total profits soared for the Fortune 500 companies. Total profits soared 81%. Forbes goes on to say, but guess who didn't benefit much from this giant wave of cash? Millions of U.S. workers stuck mired in a stagnant job market. Nevertheless, they write, we've rarely seen such a stark gulf between the fortunes of the 500 and those of ordinary citizens. Now, combine that with the fact that corporate tax revenues are at the lowest that they've been probably in 60 years. The amount of money that corporations pay to the government, probably at the lowest it's been in 60 years. And they talk about trickle-down economics. I mean, we've been living under that fantasy for quite some time, that if we give the wealthy in this nation all that they could possibly want, give it to them at the top, and somehow it's going to just magically pour, trickle down upon us. The reality is sane, rational thinking people know that's a load of dung. But the right keeps shoveling it at us. I guess no sense of wasting a good frame. But now we have a record number of Americans receiving unemployment, food stamps, government assistance in one way or another. Our economy's in a shambles. And corporate America's doing great, man. They are just doing great. 81% they've seen their profits go up. And yet here we are, May 20th, going to see the extended unemployment benefits gone here in the state of Pennsylvania. You know, what happened to that trickle down? What happened to the trickle? Where is it? Where's the trickle? Because we have filled their pockets. They're sitting on trillions of dollars of cash. They should be creating jobs. Isn't that what they told us? If we give them loans, they'll create jobs. If we do all this stuff, we give them everything, create jobs. Well, where are the jobs? I haven't seen the trickle. Personally, I think we've been hosed, but no trickle. And then comes the report. Reuters reported that this group, the Boston Consulting Group, they claim in the next few years there's going to be a wave of reinvestment here into the U.S. by these big multinational manufacturers because they're expecting the yuan to go up. They're expecting Chinese currency, obviously, to go up. And China is going to be a less attractive place to do business, they said. And the idea is if they can push up China and tear us down. That's the main part of it. And they talk about a couple of places that have NRC, NCR Corporation. They're going to bring their teller machines to be built back here in Georgia. And the toy maker Wham-O is going to bring their Frisbees and hula hoops back from China and Mexico. Going to create a couple of jobs. But at the end of it, what they're talking about is they're almost to the point where American manufacturers, these big multinationals, think that things are ripe here in the U.S. for low wages, for low benefits. And it basically means that when they finally think that they've taken health care away and pensions away and all of the wage increases away, that they can come back and they can profit off of us. I think that's what it is. It's that whole beggar thy neighbor, thing. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk with Amanda Marcott. She blogs at Pandagon. It's like Pandagon. At Double X and RH Reality Check. We're right back after this.
Show, changing America for the better. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. 500 Rite Aid workers took every anti-union tactic and trick that the giant company could throw at them, and after a five-year struggle, they're proud members of the ILWU with their first contract. International Longshore and Warehouse Union spokesman, Craig Merrilies.
it took a long time because the company decided to launch an all-out anti-union attack. The remarkable thing is that the workers stood together, fought back, were not intimidated, and despite firings, threats, and other forms of coercion, they stuck together, hung in there, and were able to continue to take action on the shop floor and motivate thousands of community supporters in California and around the country to support them.
So much for the suggestion that if voters actually knew how much Social Security and Medicare contributed to the budget, they'd be willing to cut it, Jesse Russell reports.
A new poll out by Quinnipiac University has some clarifying numbers as we enter the long 2012 election season. Voters, overwhelmingly, like Medicare. 70% of those polled and told that Medicare was a major part of the federal budget said they were against limiting the program. 72% were against limiting Social Security. However, when the same question was asked for defense funding, 54% of voters polled supported cutting that part of the budget. In a statement, Quinnipiac Polling Assistant Director Peter Brown said his organization wanted to see if voters responded differently if it was made clear how much of the budget those three issues comprised. Voters also told the firm by a margin of 69% to 28%. They support raising taxes for households earning $250,000 or more. Quinnipiac also asked voters how enthusiastic they are regarding the current lineup of Republican presidential candidate potentials. Mitt Romney and Sarah Palin had the highest enthusiasm level, tying with 15%.
The Economic Policy Institute says that as of 2010, the North American Free Trade Agreement had displaced 682,900 U.S. jobs. A new report from EPI says that when NAFTA was proposed, supporters predicted that it would create hundreds of thousands of jobs for Americans. That did not happen. Economists at EPI says despite NAFTA costing rather than creating hundreds of thousands of jobs, nearly identical jobs claims are now being made about proposed NAFTA-style trade agreements. EPI says growing trade deficits nearly always lead to job losses, and the pending Korea's free trade agreement will likely result in growing trade deficits and job losses for the U.S. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
You know, I remember, again, I go back to this often. The November elections were, according to the Republicans, about jobs. They kept telling us they're the paycheck party. Yet not one thing have they done that would create a job. Everything has been back to the old wedge issues because, again, they have no vision, no idea of what to do other than campaign. And they need these wedge issues to divide people. And I looked the other day, they rammed through their anti-abortion bill again that really, I think, goes way, way outside the mainstream. This redefinition of what rape is by Chris Smith, again, to me, one of these really scary moments in our country, I think, when you've got people like this deciding important policy. It scares me. That's why I've asked Amanda Marcotte to come on and talk to us. She's a blogger at Pandagon, also Double X and RH Reality. She's written two books on feminism and politics. Amanda, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, thank you.
You know, I look at this bill that they rammed through, H.R. 3, the No Taxpayer Funding for Abortions Act, which I already thought we didn't do anyway. But again, they, you know, you can't kill a bad political idea enough. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, you're right. They have already banned any federal funding for abortion. It's been banned actually longer than I've been alive. It was banned in 1976 under the Hyde Amendment, and it has been banned since then. What this bill is going to do is it's going to create a tax penalty for somebody who uses private money to pay for private insurance that covers abortion. So they're basically penalizing people for having private choices with their own money.
And it's interesting that, you know, the party that loves to say, get government out of the private market and let the private market decide, they're interjecting themselves right into the private market.
Yes, yeah. It's actually kind of an interesting thing because the Republican Party has always stood against using tax code to try and influence behavior. They always say they're against it. They say they're against it in the more mundane, everyday ways, such as cigarette taxes or taxes on gasoline or things like that. But then they're willing to turn around and use the income tax code to try and make abortion more expensive for women.
You know, the thing that really bothers me in all of this, and you know, I'm the father of, I've got two daughters, and I fear for their future, this redefinition of what rape is. This really kind of has me freaked out. Representative Chris Smith, Republican from New Jersey, again, this narrow definition scares me.
Yeah, it should. I mean, the original bill had said that you could only get an exception for forcible rape. They changed that wording, but then they snuck it back in with a congressional report that would basically control how the legislation is interpreted in the law. So what they basically are trying specifically to do is make sure that teenage girls who are victims of statutory rape cannot get their abortions covered under their insurance plans, their parents' insurance plans in most cases. I think that this is completely ridiculous. What we can, you know, go over and over whether or not we should treat statutory rape the same as we do other kinds of rape, but I don't think the mainstream of America is really behind the idea that we should make it harder for teenage girls to avoid having babies.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And what bothers me is we see this attack, instead of making the environment more conducive for people wanting to bring children to the world, they're simply putting down a hammer and saying you have to. That's where I have a problem. Back in November, they said they were going to be the party of the paycheck. When time's good and the economy is good, people are more willing to bring children into the world one way or another. And that's, to me, where they should be focusing their attention.
I agree. I mean, and particularly with this, you're looking at a situation where they've resisted getting health care reform in every way possible. And if you take a step back and look at HR 3, it is just another attack on health care reform. It's an attempt to use the health care bill to try and take away some of the benefits that the Democratic Party gave us, you know, the tax subsidies and whatnot. And, you know, if you want to talk about what's going to make people want to have children, having guaranteed health care would be at the top of the list. But I think this is even about more than abortion. It's about them trying to chip away at health care reform in any angle that they can have. Abortion's just sort of the first one they've got.
Well, I'm of the mindset that they really don't have an idea of what to do. Now that they control the House, they really don't have an idea of how to lead. They don't have a vision for what the country is going to be in 5 years. So they're falling back on wedge issues to keep us looking at the shiny thing. This doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell of passing the Senate. This is nothing but a waste of time, a waste of taxpayer dollars, a waste of legislative time when we could have been doing something really important like creating jobs.
Agreed. I mean, I think that they're basically just sort of looking for a way to not enact the Democratic agenda. So they're just going to pass one pointless, useless bill after another and waste the Democrats' time and just avoid talking about the issues.
Yeah, and actually go out and raise more money for themselves. Because again,
yes.
You know, this they can't get this to go away. If abortion were to go away tomorrow, so would all of their talking points and all of their fundraising.
Pretty much. I mean, it's kind of interesting how much abortion has become the number one issue for the Republican Party. And I think a part of that is because they're losing gay rights as an issue to demagogue about.
Yeah, and you know, I wanted to get your thought on the one guy's statement. He said something that just really made us kind of, I shouldn't say laugh, but it caught us off guard.
Taxpayers to pay for the indiscriminate killing of helpless little baby Americans is not good government.
I mean, when you hear something like that, what do you think?
I think that I hear a politician who has given up being honest for so long that he just doesn't even know what it sounds like anymore to say something that sounds honest, because that is so clearly silly, so clearly not reality-based, so clearly just has nothing to do with anything in American life. And it disturbs me because one in three American women in this country, or one in three American women will have an abortion before she's 45 years old. So when they get on the floor of the House and they scream about killing babies and they say abortion is the most violent thing you can do, they're kind of accusing a third of American women of being murdered. They've completely lost it. They have no idea what they're talking about. It has nothing to do with reality anymore.
Let me ask you this, because one of my beliefs is that this is the first step in really rolling back the entire 20th century for women. But once, if they were able to get rid of abortion, make it illegal, I do believe they would then go after birth control. The Griswold decision back in the 60s, they would try and undo, and basically taking women back to subservience to men, which, you know, as a man, I don't know that I would mind. But again, like I said, I've got two daughters. I don't want that to be their future.
You might mind a contraception-free world, which is what the organized anti-abortion movement also wants. And you're right, they're going after contraception next. The whole thing with the trying to shut down Planned Parenthood, almost shutting down the federal government in order to shut down Planned Parenthood, was about contraception at its base. They were claiming that they didn't want to fund Planned Parenthood because they perform abortions, but Planned Parenthood doesn't get any federal money for abortions. All of that money was for contraception, STD testing and treatment, and cancer screening. So, I mean, you have to look at not what people say, but what they do. And what they are doing is consistently attacking not just abortion rights, but contraception. So, you know, tomorrow is here. They're already making the move for birth control.
So, you know, like John Kyle said, Planned Parenthood doesn't, 90% of their work isn't killing little American babies?
No. Abortion is about 3% of their services. Most of their services are preventive care, and most of it is examining women and providing contraception. I think they've estimated that Planned Parenthood, I forget exactly what the numbers are, but Guttmacher has said that Planned Parenthood prevents hundreds of thousands of abortions a year just in their contraception services.
And to me, that's what you should be doing. Let me ask you kind of a personal question. Either you or someone you know who's had an abortion, did you have a big party? Was there a big celebration that you had this abortion? And there was, because the way my quote unquote my pro birth people explain it to me, that there's like big parties and they're gleeful at the killing of these fetuses. Have you had that experience?
No, I've never had an abortion, but I've certainly had friends who have, and I would definitely say that most of the time they're just kind of sad that it got to that point.
So no big parties or anything like that? No glee? No joy?
No, it's usually a sad occasion. I wouldn't say it's like your mom dying or anything, but it's not fun for anybody involved.
And would it be safe to say that most people would rather it not happen? Because what I hear, no, I'm serious, because I have people who think that this stuff goes on and they're happy about it, and there's some kind of weird pride that goes on with this, and I'm not getting that from people that I talk to who have been in this situation.
No, I think we can safely say that no woman wants an abortion. I mean, that's like saying, does somebody want to get a tooth drilled? At its bare minimum, that's just silly. It's ridiculous. It's painful. It's an invasive medical procedure. And more importantly, doctors don't want to have to do as many abortions as they have to. When you get an abortion, before your abortion, after your abortion, at many parts during the whole process, they're telling you contraception here, contraception there. If you need help getting contraception, we will help you get contraception. Doctors want to not have to see you come in for an abortion if they can help it.
So would you say that someone like Bristol Palin, who took a whole boatload of money
from this Candy Foundation to go out and talk about her experience. Do you think it was a positive experience for people to see her out there promoting abstinence-only education or not?
I think that's completely ridiculous. I mean, I don't even think I can't imagine a single teenager taking one look at Bristol Palin and thinking, I'm going to wait until marriage. I just don't think that relates in any way, shape, or form to how teenagers think about sex. I think most of the research shows that teenagers have sex because they basically want to, and showing them Bristol Palin and giving them a couple lectures is not going to work. It's never worked. I think that's been tried for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and so far we have no evidence that it's worked.
Yeah, I think the people who are the old curmudgeons who are trying to push this legislation along, I think it's been too many years since they were a teenager, too many years since something like that happened to them.
Yes. I think we as adults can often forget how much your hormones are just sort of racing when you're an adolescent.
And at the end of the day, it's about education. It's about education. It's not about punishment and retribution, which is what the right loves so much. They love punishment and retribution.
Yes, absolutely.
I appreciate your time. You've been great. Thanks so much. Amanda Marcotte, blogger over at Pandagon. We've got a link over at thericksmithshow.com to get you over there. Amanda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
The nuclear power boys are weaseling again, this time in Vermont. Entergy Corporation, an electric utility giant based in New Orleans, owns the Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Plant, which is nearing the end of its 40-year license to operate. No problem. Here's a 20-year extension of your license, said the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission, a notorious industry lapdog. But wait, said Vermont officials. Entergy signed an agreement with us to seek state approval for continuing to operate the 40-year-old reactor, and our legislature has decided, in a word, no. So the corporation has gone running to federal court to weasel out of its state agreement, arguing that federal authority takes precedent over locals on nuclear matters. Entergy insists that decisions made by Vermont's legislature are political, whereas the NRC decision to extend the license is made by experts. Besides, says an Entergy executive, Vermont Yankee has gotten good safety and performance ratings from an industry group. So trust us. An industry group? Isn't that like saying your mother thinks you're doing a good job? Curiously, Entergy refuses to release the industry report. Trust us, it says again. No. The Vermont Yankee nuke plant is the same vintage and make as the number one reactor at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi plant, and it has recently had embarrassing operational issues. For example, corporate officials testified to legislators in 2009 that radioactive tritium could not leak into soil and water because the facility had no buried pipes. Trust us, they reiterated. But only a few months later, a tritium leak from an underground pipe was discovered. This is Jim Hightower saying, trust us? Not on our lives. That's why decisions on nuclear power must be political. The people, not experts, must rule.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Just when he thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alert.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, if you want to contact me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com, I do answer all emails personally. Well, you know, the crazy right-wing alert. It turns out that Donald has been, well, he's been snubbed. No IndyCar for the Donald. Evidently, he was chosen to drive the pace car at this month's Indianapolis 500. But the folks over there at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, they've come out and said, well, sorry, Donald, not going to happen. In fact, the official statement was Donald J. Trump today informed the Indianapolis Motor Speedway that he may be announcing shortly his intention to run for president of the United States, and therefore he thought it appropriate to drive the pace car for the 100th anniversary. So no Donald there at the pace car. So, you know, I guess you're fired. You know, you've been trumped. Whatever jokes you want to use, feel free to go right on ahead and do that. Starting now. Anyway, well, can you imagine what would happen if the wig flew off? Just a thought. Anyway, Republicans are still fuming about the National Labor Relations Board Boeing decision, losing their minds, in fact. So much so that Senator Jim DeMint, the Republican from South Carolina, took to the floor of the Senate and said, the administration, I believe, is acting like thugs that you might see in a third world country, trying to bully and intimidate employers. Senator Lindsey Graham, the other Republican from South Carolina, he has actually put forth legislation to defund just the single complaint that was filed against Boeing. I'm not quite sure how you're going to do that. I don't know how that would work. But if it does, can we go back retroactively and defund the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision? Can we do that? Can we go and retroactively defund the AT&T decision or the Rent-A-Center decision? Can we do that? Can we go backwards and do that? I mean, honestly, I'm not a huge fan of the NLRB, personally. I think they, like anybody, can be used to destroy exactly what they're supposed to be protecting. It's all in who's in charge of it. During the Bush years, the NLRB was no friend to workers at all. In fact, they used it to stick it to workers. In fact, I would be in favor of defunding the whole thing so that we have none of that and we just have people taking to the streets. But that's not going to happen. What is interesting, however, is how angry they are over this one single NLRB decision, which I think was honestly and truthfully, honestly, right on the money. And the question that you should ask is, do workers have rights or not? Do you have the right to strike or don't you? So now what we're seeing, we have seen the emergence of the Gang of 19, these 19 Republican senators who have vowed that they are going to defeat President Obama's nominations for the National Labor Relations Board. The Gang of 19 evidently sent a letter to the president saying that they were going to vigorously oppose and do whatever it takes, to block the nominations of the acting general counsel, Leif Solomon, and board member Craig Becker. You remember that there was a whole shindig, whole to-do about Becker that the Republicans were furious about because they were really trying to hold him up. So you got the 19 Republicans who have said that the NLRB suit against Boeing is an attack on millions of workers in the 22 right-to-work states, as well as government-led act of intimidation against American companies who should have the freedom to choose to build their plants in right-to-work states. And they rambled on to say if the NLRB prevails, it will only encourage companies to make their, and you'll love this, make their investments in foreign nations, moving jobs and economic growth overseas. Again, this is nothing more than union busting and middle class destruction. And they're pitting basically the northern states against the southern states. I mean, it's really kind of bizarre how you've got a governor down in South Carolina who is saying that she's going to do whatever she can do to steal workers' rights away. Nothing more than union busting, in my opinion. So on Wednesday, both of the Republican senators from South Carolina, Graham and DeMint, in conjunction with the Republican senator from Tennessee, Lamar Alexander, they have put you know, introduce their no rights at work agenda. They want to bar the federal government from suing or denying contracts to states because of their right to work status. So basically what they're saying is you can come out, you can violate the labor laws of this country, and you can get away with it under the guise that, well, you're harming a right to work state. Look, this has nothing to do with the right to work for less status. It has nothing to do with this. It has everything to do with the fact that Boeing said out loud and in public that they were moving solely because their workers went on strike. That, my friends, is illegal. And if you don't like that, then change that part of it. Let's debate that. Let's have that conversation. But none of this backdoor stuff. You got Orrin Hatch, who was one of the gang's members. He said it would cost billions of dollars and tens of thousands of jobs to have this decision go the other way. So I guess if I'm getting this right, there is no recourse. The damage is done. The corporation wins no matter what happens to the workers. So basically, sorry, workers, you've been screwed again. But hey, you know, it's kind of like the Republican point of view on most women's issues, especially when it comes to rape. You know, I guess the workers must have been asking for it. And you look at this one single decision. It has them just infuriated that they're trying to figure out a way to just defund one complaint because they know they're wrong. And they don't want you to think that you have any rights. If this goes the way of the workers, this is a massive case, because people will then go, what? We have rights? They'll be broken from their Stockholm syndrome. They'll be able to maybe look away from their terrorizers for a second. Oh, we've got rights. Maybe we should demand them. And I say yes. It's about time. But at the end of this, it's not going to go anywhere. The court system is going, the very conservative court system is going to side with the business community, because that's why they were put there. And the Republicans did a great job. The moneyed interests did a great job in appointing people who had their social values there, but also were corporatists. You look at the Supreme Court. Well over 70% of the decisions where business has a stake in the game, business wins. Well over 70%. You and I, we don't have a voice in this stuff. We lose. And the important thing to remember about this Boeing case, if those workers in Washington don't have a union, we never hear about it. That plant just moves. So I guess the question that you should ask, and one that I ask often, should you have a voice in what happens in your community? Should you have a voice in where you spend a third of your life? Should you have some say? And I say you should. I don't think we should be at the will, at the behest, at the mercy of the moneyed interests. I'm sorry. I think we should have some way of shaping our economy, of shaping our communities for their stability and common good. Maybe that's me. Maybe it's just me. Because on so many levels, you see this stripping of rights from people. And a lot of times, rights they didn't even know they had. I mean, I think that's the problem in this country. We think we have more rights than we do, and the ones that we do have, we don't know. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about this weight limit on these trucks. Again, you know, seeing trucks driving up and down the road with 100,000 pounds on it, I'm not so sure about. Doesn't sound like a good idea to me. But when we come back, Todd Spencer, Executive Vice President of the Owner Operators Independent Drivers Association, back after this.
Radio of, for, and by working people. The Rick Smith Show.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control.
My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
Now, as we've been talking about this week, there's a push by the business community to increase the weight that big rigs can haul down the road. I think it's a really bad idea. I think it's dangerous. I think it's going to harm our infrastructure. But, you know, there are those who want to sit. And the claim is that, you know, hey, the drivers don't mind, which is why I've asked Todd Spencer, Executive Vice President of the Owner Operator Independent Drivers Association, to come talk to us a little bit about what his members think. Todd, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, glad to be part of the show, Rick. And yeah, some people might think that's a great idea, but I can tell you it's not the overwhelming majority of people that drive those trucks.
Yeah, I know when I drove, I didn't want it, especially going up and down the hills.
Well, bigger and heavier has been a net loser for the industry. And like I said, truck owners, truck drivers, virtually everybody, almost day one. The promoters, the pushers of this are primarily shipping interests that aren't concerned with the quality of our highway along our bridges last, or they're certainly not concerned about contributing to paying for those things. So, you know, it's just an opportunity. If they see an opportunity to get something hauled for a penny or two less, they're all over it.
Yeah, and again, this is all about adding to their bottom line. This isn't going to help the consumer. This isn't going to help the drivers. This isn't going to help the workers. It's about adding to the shippers' bottom lines.
Yep. That's exactly that. And generally, it's generally special interests that do the pushing on this. Sometimes it's paper, sometimes it's logging. It's always agriculture. And sometimes it's steel. And, you know, the strategy that's most often employed right now is simply, well, let's just give states an option.
Right.
If a state wants to do it, let the state make its own decision. Well, seen before, what happens? There used to be a time when states could pretty much go their own way, and one state would get played off against another, and pretty soon they've got weight limits that are way on up.
Yep. Over the years, how if you know, in your experience, how have these weight limits gone up? For a while, it's been a gross vehicle weight of 80,000 pounds, but I know it was less than that several years back. Any information on that?
Yeah, actually, going back into the 70s, there were a number of states that had weights that were like 72,000 or 73,280. And actually, certainly one of those times, Pennsylvania was one of those states, but there was basically a band of states across the center of the country from Mississippi all the way up to Minnesota that basically had lower weight limits. And so they could realistically, entire country, interstate shipments, something that would go east coast to west coast. In that particular instance, we thought, uniform is better. Every thing, if you load in New York and you're going to California, you'd be legal all the way across. It makes no sense to jump back and forth. So all the way back, this would be 1982, lawmakers reached the same conclusion. We need one uniform standard, and so that standard was determined then to be 80,000. But they also allowed those states that had what they call grandfather clauses in their state law that allowed heavier, they allowed them to keep those. And so we have some states that have heavier weight limits out west.
Like Michigan.
There are some states in the east that will allow on toll roads, on the turnpike, they'll allow heavier. But, you know, even then with a uniform national standard for federal agricultural interests, still pushing for more.
Yeah. Well, so what are your drivers saying? I mean, to me, you know, I think about going up and down some of these big hills, some of the mountains, especially when you get out towards towards Montana and Colorado. What are they saying from a safety standpoint?
Well, you know, there are obviously driving in the mountains in the wintertime when there's snow on the ground, the weather's really bad, icy. It's, you know, it's bad enough as things are now. The more weight you have, the more momentum, the more push you can have on a really, really slick surface. And, you know, coming down mountains is one where it really, it certainly is not going to make that task any easier at all. You know, we correct professional people, for the most part. Experienced members of our organization average 20 years of experience. They handle the equipment they have, but no matter how good you are, you know, the bigger you are, the worse the weather is, margins of safety do get strained.
Right. So let me ask you this. In looking at this push for a larger weight limit, I seem to kind of try and put things together. I look at the fact that we're talking about opening up the Mexican border. As you've said, the agricultural people are the ones who are generally pushing stuff. It's the agricultural folks who are pushing opening up the Mexican border. How much do you think opening the border, pushing these weight limits, are they're doing? And what are your thoughts about opening up the border?
Well, you know, big shippers generally always want heavier. You know, agricultural interests are in support of opening the border, but you know, the biggest supporter, the biggest push came for customers. And that is the most funded, most influential group in Washington. Generally, what they want, they get.
Yeah.
And throw that border open wide. You know, they've wanted it for 10 years with the previous administration, and it kind of follows on with this administration as well.
Yeah, and I don't see any American drivers going into Mexico. Do you think any of your members would go into Mexico?
No. You know, and that's ironic. Within the past month, the State Department has issued two warnings for U.S. citizens or U.S. drivers about not going into Mexico. I mean, it's a ludicrous deal. It is totally a one-way street. And, of course, Mexico simply cannot comply. And no amount of bending over backwards, you know, that our government is trying to do is actually going to change that.
Yeah, I mean, this is a bad deal in my estimation. And again, you know, when you look at these two things together, when it does open, because I think, as you've pointed out, the agricultural people are one of the folks pushing this. They're the powerful, influential lobby here. They're gonna get what they want.
The ag pork producers. There actually are about 140 groups that belong to what I think it's an organization called KeepUSJobs.org. You can look it up on their website. It says KeepUSJobs.org, but they're all about opening the border with Mexico. So basically, basically lower cost labor will come up here and displace U.S. workers. Now, I don't know what jobs they think that we're going to keep by doing that. But, I mean, you know, it's smoke and mirrors. It's just the run-of-the-mill BS that too often can carry the day in Washington.
Yeah, I fear here in our area, we're in the I-81 corridor, and a lot of truck traffic through here. I fear they jack these weight limits up. We're going to see even more accidents. We're going to see even more overturned trucks and even more problems. I think that's the wrong way to go. If anything, I would be in favor of going the other way.
Well, realistically, it won't make it, you know, it wouldn't really be practical to roll back things. But at the same time, you know, these things are legislative proposals, and there are proposals on the table to increase the weight limits, but there are also proposals on the table to keep them exactly where they are.
Right.
And those are the ones that we're supporting.
And again, you know, that's right now the best we can do. But, you know, where we live down here in Harrisburg, where we're at often, you see a 53-foot trailer coming through with a sleeper cab down here. No way you're moving those trucks around.
Well, you know, the curious thing, or not, I mean, it's sort of curious for me, but I'm from the Midwest. I used to truck in places like Pittsburgh, and these are areas of the country that basically were developed, were designed roads, warehouses, buildings when trucks were nowhere near as big as they are now. And you know, normal size trucks, they don't accommodate all that well.
Now, I've heard rumor, and I don't know if maybe you would have a better insight. There's talk that I've heard of increasing the length of the trailers from 53 upwards of 59 and a half. Have you heard anything?
Well, there are 57-foot trailers that are legal in Texas right now. I mean, again, there are people who always want more, and it makes no sense to make trailers longer because you have a hard enough time getting around corners right now. Yeah. I mean, our roads weren't designed for it, you know, and, you know, this administration is sort of following the previous administration, as they don't really want to talk about how we will pay for roads and bridges. We've customarily done it with fuel taxes. The previous guys wanted to sell off our roads so they could all be toll roads and necessarily belong to U.S. interests. And, you know, the same people that wanted that in the previous administration are pushing forward in this one, too.
Yeah, it seems the more things change, the more they stay the same, Todd.
Well, I mean, it just goes to show the economic interests are going to push regardless of what party is that has the reins of power, so to speak.
So what do we do to stop this?
Well, certainly I would encourage every listener to this to call their lawmaker and tell them no way in heck do we need trucks to go up here. And by the same token, we certainly do not need bigger and heavier trucks.
I'm right there with you. Todd Spencer, I appreciate the time, brother.
All right, Rick.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What do you say? Bigger trucks? Heavier? Can you imagine the bridge collapsing under you? I sure hope not. Back after this.
Defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Official supporter of Palin Santorum 2012. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember to check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. Also, you can go to our Facebook page. You can go to Facebook, look up Rick Smith or the Rick Smith Show, and make a comment there. Also, for everyone who voted for Todd Farley, be sure to throw a vote for our friend Matt Osborne in the Roots Nation voting. We'd love to see both of them end up there at Netroots Nation. So, good stuff. Anyway, you ever had one of those moments where you lost exactly what you were doing? And then you go, up, there it is, found it. I am here. On Tuesday night, the governor of Virginia, his name's Bob McDonald, he announced that he was going to cut $424,000 from public broadcasting. Now, look, people understand that, you know, public broadcasting is something for the public good. Evidently not according to Mr. McDonald, who says in one of his written pieces, such grants are not core services of government. How many times have we heard that? He says, especially given the scarcity of resources during these difficult times, such grants ought to be eliminated. He says that he is confident that the excellent work done by public television and radio will continue with generous contributions from the private sector. In return for them selling out their souls. And I find it interesting that at a time when we're going after public television, we're going after public radio, we're going after this, you see this story of the former FCC general counsel, Erwin Krasnow, who has written this this piece claiming that the public-owned airwaves is an outdated concept. He says, quote, the concept that the public owns the airwaves, particularly as it concerns the authority and mission of the FCC, is a mischievous notion that has been misused as a rationalization for government regulation. He's also pushing the idea that, anything that is owned by the public, especially on the airwaves, is absurd. So again, you know, what they want is they want complete control of everything that is ours, everything that is part of the community. And I love this idea that the right is trying to push. Well, we don't need to do anything for the public good with the airwaves. They're not public anymore. We own them. They're private. They're ours. And if we want to put crummy right-wing hate radio on 24/7, by God, we're going to do it. And we're not going to have any of that NPR stuff. And we're not going to have any of that public television, Nova, and none of that educational stuff. We want gold-fashioned propaganda. We want the BS right up under our nose so we can get a good whiff of it. Because evidently that's what we seem to think, because the outrage isn't there yet. They went after the Public Broadcasting Corporation, and the Republicans are, yeah, take them down. And now they're saying, oh, you know, hey, wait a second. The public airways aren't really the public's. They're the private corporations. And the private corporation, they should be able to do whatever they want to do. Stop and think about that for a couple of minutes. The fact that they're really working very hard to steal what is, well, what is the commons? What is ours? What it is that we have been fighting for some time. Amazing stuff. And next is the election process. You know, they don't want you to have a say. And I look at what's going on in Wisconsin right now. The Republicans who, you know, they said they were going to somehow, they were going to get three Democrats recalled. Turns out, amazingly, I guess maybe not such amazingly, turns out that our Republican friends went and hired felons and went and hired less than desirable folks to go out and run their petition drives. And they're finding that a good percentage of these signatures, really a very good percentage, are fraudulent. A good number of them were misrepresented. So now here's the question. Do we go and disband? Do we go after the Republican Party? Do we defund the Republican Party? Do we go after them, put them in jail? Because if you remember, and this is one of those things that kind of gives me a chuckle, the whole idea of Acorn, the right had to take down Acorn because they said that they were registering people to vote fraudulently, even though it was Acorn who turned the people in, who said, look, these signatures to us look wrong. Will you check them? We're turning our people in. Well, the right took that as, oh, they're being fraudulent. The fraud was really the fraud was against Acorn. It wasn't Acorn who was being fraudulent. Acorn had hired some people to go out and get signatures, go door to door and knock on doors and collect signatures. They paid for those signatures. Now the Republicans are doing the exact same thing. So I ask the question, why should it not be the exact same punishment? Why should we not be going after them lock, stock, and barrel? Why should we not be hunting them down? I love some of the numbers that you're seeing of the fraud. In Senate District 12, of the 534 people contacted who signed the petition, over 9% of them claimed they were misled into signing the petition or had asserted they never signed the petition. In District 22, of the 225 people contacted whose name was on the petition, almost 7% of them said they didn't sign it or they were misled into signing it. In District 30, the other one that the Republicans got, of the 372 people that were contacted there, almost 9% again said either we didn't sign it or we thought we were signing something else. And you go down the list and you look at the reality that, man, they are just no shame whatsoever. No shame whatsoever. Because the reality is the people of Wisconsin didn't want the Democrats recalled. They sure as shine wanted the Republicans recalled, especially Randy Hopper, who I got to be honest, I love this ad, Randy. I love it.
Sexy guy, welcome to an exciting new way to go live one-on-one with hot, horny girls waiting right now to
thank you, Randy.
You. Lie back, baby. Relax and get ready to meet the local students, housewives, and working girls from all over the country. Hundreds of hot girls call free all day and night because we love nasty talk as much as you do. Hot amateur talk and voice personals for just 99 cents per minute.
That's how you fund this campaign.
One-on-one talk with a nasty girl who'll do anything you want for just $2.99 per minute.
Ooh.
This service is brought to you by Intimate Encounters. You must be over 18. Enter your credit card now to join the fun.
I never get tired of that. And, you know, here's the thing. When he put out his literature to, you know, to find out the facts, the facts about his campaign and the smear against him, that's where he sent people to go. So one of two things happened. One, it was a simple typo. Or two, that's what he had on his speed dial when they went up a number. That was his quote-unquote campaign office. You know, while he wasn't living in a different area with his 25-year-old mistress. I mean, that's the greatest part of this all. I mean, under that hell hath no fury as a woman scorned category, how would you like to have the opportunity, if your husband or your wife were stepping out, run across town with someone else, the opportunity to sign a recall petition against them, which is exactly what happened. The people went to the guy's house, and the woman said, no, he lives in Madison with his mistress half his age. And they said, really, would you like to sign our petition? And she goes, you bet I would. And evidently she signed it, as did the housekeeper. So good for them. But, man, I'll tell you, at the end of this, it's got to come down to we need sane, rational people. And speaking of irrational folks, there's a guy named Rob Bishop, Republican member of the study committee, basically the head hypocrite over there, a guy who in the past has said that oil subsidies never existed. Really, he believed that. He said, no, it never denied, never happened. We don't give money to the oil companies. No, no, no. Here's what he said. Let's tax the oil company. What a wonderful non sequitur, he said in a sarcastic tone. How are you going to produce more oil by taxing oil companies? How do you actually believe that tax will not actually be passed along to consumers? Why don't you quit trying to demonize success and creating a straw man to lift the burden away from the fact that the de facto moratorium, lack of action, foot dragging, red tape, glacial speed by this administration is what's causing our oil shortages? The problem is I'm not quite sure how handing billions of dollars over to an oil company where the money ends up going straight to their profit, I don't know how that helps us. And these are wildly profitable companies, and the truth is they're going to raise their prices with or without welfare from us. But I find it interesting that our head hypocrite here is saying, well, you know, if it weren't for them, we wouldn't have energy. Yeah, we would. I mean, anyway, the Congressional Joint Economic Committee, they looked at domestic manufacturing. They looked at the subsidies that we give to these domestic manufacturers and found that in the long run, if we were to take away these tax deductions, if we were to take away these subsidies, they're saying it would have no effect on consumer prices on gas and oil at all. And I look at Bush's economic advisor, Douglas Holtz-Eakin, who admitted that basically offshore drilling is not going to lower gas prices. He came out and said, you're not going to drill your way out of this. It's not going to happen. We need to start looking for other sources of energy. And you look at the reality is, ExxonMobil, the most profitable company in the history of the world, the most profitable company on the Forbes 500 list, they're riding high. They took $30 billion in 2010. They filled their pockets with $30 million. Exxon made over $10 billion more than the fellow oil giant Chevron, the third most profitable company. And ConocoPhillips, $11.4 billion in profit. I mean, you look at all the profits from the oil companies, almost $61 billion. Do we really need to give them more subsidies? Do we really need to give them more welfare? Because evidently what we're giving them is not bringing the price down, but it is going to their bottom line. And you look at this almost $61 billion in pure profit in their pocket, hand out to their buddies. 234 Republicans voted to block a bill eliminating the $1.8 billion annual subsidy that treats oil drilling as domestic manufacturing. You know, when you think about manufacturing, I think about building stuff. I don't think about poking holes in the ground. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. 500 Rite Aid workers took every anti-union tactic and trick that the giant company could throw at them, and after a five-year struggle, they're proud members of the ILWU with their first contract. International Longshore and Warehouse Union spokesman Craig Merrilies.
It took a long time because the company decided to launch an all-out anti-union attack. The remarkable thing is that the workers stood together, fought back, were not intimidated, and despite firings, threats, and other forms of coercion, they stuck together, hung in there, and were able to continue to take action on the shop floor and motivate thousands of community supporters in California and around the country to support them.
So much for the suggestion that if voters actually knew how much Social Security and Medicare contributed to the budget, they'd be willing to cut it. Jesse Russell reports.
A new poll out by Quinnipiac University has some clarifying numbers as we enter the long 2012 election season. Voters overwhelmingly like Medicare. 70% of those polled and told that Medicare was a major part of the federal budget said they were against limiting the program. 72% were against limiting Social Security. However, when the same question was asked for defense funding, 54% of voters polled supported cutting that part of the budget. In a statement, Quinnipiac Polling Assistant Director Peter Brown said his organization wanted to see if voters responded differently if it was made clear how much of the budget those three issues comprised. Voters also told the firm by a margin of 69% to 28%. They support raising taxes for households earning $250,000 or more. Quinnipiac also asked voters how enthusiastic they are regarding the current lineup of Republican presidential candidate potentials. Mitt Romney and Sarah Palin had the highest enthusiasm level, tying with 15%.
The Economic Policy Institute says that as of 2010, the North American Free Trade Agreement had displaced 682,900 U.S. jobs. A new report from EPI says that when NAFTA was proposed, supporters predicted that it would create hundreds of thousands of jobs for Americans. That did not happen. Economist at EPI says despite NAFTA costing rather than creating hundreds of thousands of jobs, nearly identical jobs claims are now being made about proposed NAFTA-style trade agreements. EPI says growing trade deficits nearly always lead to job losses, and the pending Korea-U.S. free trade agreement will likely result in growing trade deficits and job losses for the U.S. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. You know, again, going back to this weight issue, I think it's really a bad idea, especially, you know, you look at these roads, these bridges, major potholes, large chunks of concrete coming off of bridges. Not such a good idea. But to talk a little bit more about this, I've got Henry Jasny. He's an attorney for the Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety. 20 years he's been their general counsel there. Henry, thanks for taking time for me.
Sure, Rick. Pleasure to be here.
This whole thing, I got to be honest, I think it's just a horrible idea. Who's pushing it?
It's the trucking interests, the ATA, and they want to make more money by pushing more weight, make it more efficient, use less drivers, cut down their costs, and keep making more money.
But here's my problem with this. If we put more weight on the back of a truck, I think that at some point, aren't we taking things off of a rail? At some point, doesn't this end up harming our infrastructure even more, creating an environment for less safe roads?
Yeah, it's all moving in the wrong direction. Some years ago, we had this big drive for intermodalism to get all kinds of transportation working together, and increasing truck weights is just going to push the trucking industry to have a bigger share of freight in the country at the expense of other modes of transportation.
I mean, at some point, isn't it sane and rational? Look, I was a truck driver for years. The industry was very good to me. I don't want to see people lose their jobs, but at some point, you've got to look at the infrastructure, you've got to look at the amount of traffic, and say that some of the long haul stuff should logically be on the back of a rail car.
The most freight movements long distance are cheaper and better by rail, but the issue for us is the safety of the highways and the safety and the health of the truckers.
So walk me through this. What's the proposal?
Well, the proposal is to go up to 99 or 100,000 pounds per truck on the interstate system. The current limit is 80,000 pounds. So you're going to be increasing loads by up to 20%. And that's going to make the trucks heavier, give them more momentum. And the laws of physics say when they crash and hit something, there's going to be a worse problem on the highways, more injuries, more deaths, and more destruction and more time, frankly, in congestion when you have to clean up those spills.
Yeah. Have you guys done any research on when weight limits are raised, what kind of accident ratios you have, what kind of numbers come out of that?
Well, the biggest number that comes out of that is when you increase truck weights, and this has happened before when we got to 80,000 pounds, is you don't decrease the number of trucks on the road, you actually increase the number of trucks. It's a law of economics that when you get more efficient, people will do more of it. And so they put more trucks on the highways. And we actually saw that recently in an experiment on I-95 in Maine, where they did a one-year pilot project of allowing trucks up the way up to 100,000 pounds. And what we found is up to three times as many trucks that used that corridor before were using it when the weights went up.
Wow, that's... That's not a good thing.
No, it not only is it less safe, but it deteriorates the highways and the bridges at the expense of the federal taxpayer.
And the reality is our infrastructure is older and crumbling as we speak without the investment that we need right now just to bring it up to a reasonable level today.
It's already in bad shape and we can't fix it. And the first thing you should learn when you have common sense is if you're in a deep hole, stop digging, and this would just compound the problems.
Yeah, I remember the I-35 collapse, and part of me fears that for many of the bridges around here, since here in Pennsylvania we have a large number of these structures that are deficient.
Yeah, it's a much older infrastructure in the Northeast especially, but the average age of highway bridges on the interstate system is 40 years, and a lot of them are getting near to the end of the useful life. And increasing the total weight, the gross weights of trucks is just going to speed up that process.
So what are you guys doing to stop this?
We're supporting a bill in Congress to ship a bill that would freeze weights on all highways that are currently where they are. It's sort of like the freeze on longer trucks, doubles and triples, that happened back in 1991 to try and keep weights from going up and ratcheting up from state to state.
What do you say to those who say all we need to do is add an extra axle to the trailer and everything will be fine?
Well, that doesn't solve the problem. It makes it a little better for distribution of weight, but it doesn't solve the problem of safety. It doesn't solve the problem of having truckers have more responsibility and heavier weights when they do get in a crash. Now, a lot of the trucks that they want to shift that weight to already have a sixth axle. So when you're putting 100,000 pounds instead of 80,000 pounds on those trucks, even though they have the extra axle, you're not getting any extra braking power. So these trucks are taking longer to stop because of the extra weight and inertia that they need to stop the weight with.
And I got to be honest with you, having driven for years, it's getting much worse with people cutting in front of you, and you need longer stopping distances that sometimes not there.
Absolutely. And what that does is force people to drive at night, which while there's less congestion, a lot of the fatigue that builds up in drivers is overnight because they're driving when they should be sleeping.
Because I got to be honest, I've always said that we should be teaching drivers of cars how to drive around trucks as much as we need to teach truck drivers how to drive around cars.
Well, that would be part of the solution, but it's very hard to change the behavior of drivers and passenger vehicles to learn that. There's been a project like that that's been going on for years, and it's had little or no effect.
Yeah, the No Zone program. That's right. Again, really, you're right. It doesn't do anything.
Well, yeah, that would be an ideal, but you know, you're just not going to be able to change behavior that much that quickly with that kind of program.
Now, do you know of any? Because I've been talking to some friends who say that there's actually a push to make trailers even longer, and I can't imagine having much longer trailers. Anything on that?
Well, there's always been a push by some interest to lift the freeze on longer trailers to allow them doubles and on more roads and triples in more states. And so far we've been successful at holding the line on that with the help of Senator Lautenberg and others.
Have you guys found many drivers, the people who are actually out on the road driving these rigs, have you found many of them who are in favor of this? Because I can't imagine that you will.
Well, the ones that do drive them and drive them safely and are trained don't mind having them. But a lot of the other drivers, the single rig drivers, single trailers, are not enthusiastic about being forced to take the responsibility of driving doubles or triples.
Because I can't imagine that, you know, especially if you owned your own vehicle, you owned your own tractor, that you would want to have that kind of wear and tear either.
Yeah, no, I think there are very few owners of vehicles that independents that want to drive more than a single. It's very rare for them to invest or to take the risk of driving doubles and triples that they own.
And I understand the Teamsters Union are one of your partners in this piece of legislation that you're pushing.
Yes, they're very strong backers. The head of the union is a very vocal and strong proponent of the legislation, and is helping to work to stop the other side from passing their legislation.
Yeah, because I see this, and I was talking earlier to a guy from the Owner Operators Association, and I see this here in conjunction with opening up the Mexican border as two things working together that the business interests in this country, particularly agriculture, really, really want.
They do, because one of the things it does is it reduces the number of drivers they need to hire, so it enlarges the pool of drivers out there that they can bid for the load, so that drives down the price that they have to pay for the labor.
And also, once we open up that border, it's going to increase the number of drivers coming in from out of the country as well.
Well, that's another factor. We work on that issue, too, but only from the safety side of making sure that any trucks that do come in don't degrade safety for users of highways in the U.S.
At the end of the day, what do people do to stop this?
Well, they have to write to their congressmen and their senators to let them know that they're opposed to it, what their position is. That's the best way to communicate that, or to send it to the White House and let them know what your position is.
It all comes back to that. It all comes back to writing your congressman, call him early, call him often.
Yeah, you have to express your views, because the squeaky wheel gets the attention, and the people who stay home and don't speak up get forgotten.
Yep, and this is really an important issue. Henry Jasny, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Sure, Rick. Thanks.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Nuclear power boys are weaseling again, this time in Vermont.
Entergy Corporation, an electric utility giant based in New Orleans, owns the Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Plant, which is nearing the end of its 40-year license to operate. No problem. Here's a 20-year extension of your license, said the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission, a notorious industry lapdog. But wait, said Vermont officials. Entergy signed an agreement with us to seek state approval for continuing to operate the 40-year-old reactor, and our legislature has decided, in a word, no. So the corporation has gone running to federal court to weasel out of its state agreement, arguing that federal authority takes precedent over locals on nuclear matters. Entergy insists that decisions made by Vermont's legislature are political, whereas the NRC decision to extend the license is made by experts. Besides, says an Entergy executive, Vermont Yankee has gotten good safety and performance ratings from an industry group. So trust us. An industry group? Isn't that like saying your mother thinks you're doing a good job? Curiously, Entergy refuses to release the industry report. Trust us, it says again. No. The Vermont Yankee nuke plant is the same vintage and make as the number one reactor at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi plant, and it has recently had embarrassing operational issues. For example, corporate officials testified to legislators in 2009 that radioactive tritium could not leak into soil and water because the facility had no buried pipes. Trust us, they reiterated. But only a few months later, a tritium leak from an underground pipe was discovered. This is Jim Hightower saying, trust us? Not on our lives. That's why decisions on nuclear power must be political. The people, not experts, must rule.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out. HightowerLowdown.com.
The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Reuters reported that House Republican leader Eric Cantor told his bipartisan talks with on the U.S. Deficit Commission there that tax hikes off the table. And I'm going, you know, hold on a second. How do you walk into a bipartisan meeting and say, sorry, we're going to put a stake in the ground off the table? He said, quote, the House has taken a firm position against anything having to do with increasing taxes or raising tax rates. Now, personally, I think all options should be on the table. For the Republicans to come out and say, sorry, we're going to do, we're willing to compromise. We're there with you. We're going to compromise, but no tax increases. We're not willing to look at anything that has to do with revenue. Everything that we're going to talk about is cutting things from poor people. And you got John Boehner who's saying that he's optimistic. Optimistic about new deficit reduction talks. Because Joe Biden's come out and said, yeah, well, you know what? We may have to, you know, we're going to have to cut some stuff. He's bought into the frame that the right has thrown out there as well, that we need all these massive cuts. Boehner said, I'm always optimistic that these conversations will lead somewhere. He said, I wish them well. I hope we can come to some agreement as soon as possible. He said that, he wants real spending cuts, that they weren't going to increase the debt limit until we had real spending cuts. And again, I go back to this position that they have. It's all about cutting. It's all about the pain. It's all about the sacrifice. It's all about you taking pay cuts or right down the list. The one thing that Republicans had come out and talked about for a bit was real short-lived. David Camp, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, said that his panel will not advance the Ryan plan, this idea that we're going to privatize Medicare for future generations. He said, we're not going to do that. We're going to take that out. He said, I'm interested in finding a way forward that gets signed into law. And this is going to kind of take that back. Now, then you had Eric Cantor who came out and said, whoa, 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 whoa. No. We're not willing to take that off the table just yet. He said Medicare overhaul is still on the table. He said the starting point is the Ryan budget, period. That's the starting point. So anything that they can destroy above and beyond what Ryan is talking about destroying, to them is the way they want to go. And again, I'm sure hoping that the Democrats don't fall into this trap, which is going to be, well, you know, this is where we're starting from. We're going to start from, we've already come to the decision that Medicare is done. That's the starting point. And now let's see how much further we can go. That's what worries me, that they've already co-opted the message. They've already been able to frame the discussion. And it worries me. It worries me because these folks have this bizarre belief in the free market, that it's always the best. And in fact, you got Eric Cantor, who on Tuesday said that private health care plans ration care for profit, but that consumers should be free to buy wherever the coverage they can afford rather than depending on government. So I guess, you know, private rationing good, government rationing bad, even though I haven't seen any government rationing. Sorry, missing that. In fact, I was looking for one of the death panels. Would have loved to have been on one because I got a couple of people wouldn't mind seeing go away. That's just a joke. I really don't wish anybody ill health, even though I've had several people email me and write me letters over the years wishing me nothing but ill health. If you're still listening, Bob L., I appreciate that. But again, you know, this belief that it's only what you can buy, that you can survive if you can afford it. And we're going to give you this little voucher, and you're going to go out into the private market, and maybe you'll be able to buy something. Maybe you won't. Doesn't that worry you? I mean, aren't you worried that at some point, especially, I look at my grandmother, who fortunately was just returned home from the hospital, you know, with a whole bunch of problems, but it's, you know, fortunately she is home and resting. But who'd cover her? The answer is nobody. Absolutely nobody. And what does that mean for future generations? I mean, I think the Republicans went home and took a major, major butt whipping. They got their youngin' smacked. And they didn't know how to handle it. Because they thought that, oh, gee, they want us to cut, cut, cut. But what they didn't learn from 2008, what they didn't learn is that, you know, with all that fervor, with all that anger, with all of that, 2010, what they didn't learn is that people like Medicare. Now, granted, what we learned back through the Tea Party town halls is that people evidently didn't know that Medicare was a government program. A lot of funny moments where seniors were going, get the government out of my Medicare, and people going, wait a second, that's a government plan. But they went home to their districts, and there are hundreds of these stories where they just got beat up. They started talking about, oh, we're going to privatize Medicare, we're going to give out these vouchers, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that, and it's going to save money. Well, how's it going to save money? Well, by rationing care and making you take more money out of your pocket to pay for your health care for the rest of your life. Instead of saying, and again, we can have this conversation again because I think it's important. It's important to have the discussion about health care because you cannot possibly live a secure middle class existence in this country without health security, without the ability to say that today, tomorrow, and a year from now, 10 years from now, if I get sick, I'm going to be covered, whether I have a job or not. And I listened to Ike call a little bit before. He's been unemployed for quite some time. Nothing. No health insurance. No hope. He's got to look for charity. And I got to be honest, no self-respecting person wants to have to do that. Health care in this country should be an absolute. If you're sick, you go to the hospital. If I get arrested on the way home tomorrow, what's the first thing they say? You have the right to an attorney. If you can't afford one, one will be granted to you. Why is it we have a right to an attorney to keep us out of jail, but we don't have a right to a doctor to keep us on this planet? Now, there are a bunch of ways of going about making sure that people have health insurance. And I've talked about this quite often. I'm a firm believer in cradle to grave one company. I don't care who it is. I don't care if it's a private corporation or the government. One entity who has an interest in you being well, who has an interest in your good health. And I point to the one statistic that just really grabs me, that 95% of all amputations due to diabetes is paid for by you and me, the taxpayer, through Medicare. 95%. So we're already paying for national health care, and we're paying way too much. But what we're paying for is this profit motive, where an insurance company knows that eventually, if they stall long enough, sorry, Mr. Smith, you got diabetes. We're not going to pay for your testing supplies. Sorry, you're going to have to pay for those out of your pocket. No one, you're not going to be able to afford that. And then eventually you get bad enough to where you can't work. And now you have a situation where you're on the back of the government, or you have no health insurance. Welcome to Pay or Die America. And yet we seem to be so in love with this. And we've got politicians out there saying, well, you know, you don't want Medicare. You can keep your employer-based care into retirement. We'll give you this voucher. And you can keep that same health care that your employer gave you, that same crappy high-deductible plan with massive copays. You can keep that. We'll just give you this voucher. You can keep it till the day you die, with no guarantees that you're going to be able to keep that to the day you die. I mean, you may be able to, yeah, you can get it if you can afford it. So I say, why not take all this money? And we're spending a boatload of money making people healthy, making people well. Instead of being reactive, maybe you have a little prevention. You know, there's that guy with the kite and the key who said, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Somehow we've forgotten that. Somehow we've forgotten that, you know, going to the doctor for a checkup every year is not a bad thing. Yet to hear the right tell the story, oh, you're going to give people health insurance, then they're going to spend all their time at the doctor. You know, I saw a friend recently who I haven't talked to in some time, and he's got some problems. He's got some medical problems. And he was saying, you know, I've got the best health insurance, basically the best health insurance money can buy. Haven't been to the doctor in years. Had I gone more often, maybe you caught this stuff. Maybe. Who knows? But this concept that, oh, well, you know, if you give people insurance, they're going to go to the doctor. Ludicrous. I've got great health care. You don't see me lining up in my doctor's office every time something happens. No. I should be. I should be going more often. And we all should be. Because if you find things early, you fix them early. That's not how the industry is set up. The industry is set up to go, hey, you got cancer? There's $250,000 of revenue. What? You need a heart transplant? Great. Come on over here. That's going to be $100,000, $200,000. It's revenue. It's keeping bodies in the beds. That's a system that is a failure. I would love to see us go back to community hospitals where the hospital is there, the resources are there, and our job is not to fill the beds, but to be there when it's needed. Not to overwork nurses, not to overwork doctors, but to be there when it's needed. You know, someone said to me the other day that, you know, in their lifetime, they have seen hospitals go from being run by doctors to being run by MBAs who are chasing the bottom line. That, my friends, is what has killed the healthcare system in this country. That's why it's broken. And it annoys me when I hear people, well, we got the best health care in the world. I say, well, you need to finish the sentence. You can afford it. If you've got the best health care, if you can reach into your pocket like the very wealthy can do and pay for that service. Yeah, we do have very good health care. But for the average, everyday working stiff, the person that I care about, good luck on that. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
My name's Diane. I'm a single mom. I have twin boys who are 19, Alex and Tyler. We were a very close family, and I miss them a lot when they're away at school.
I definitely miss her. Yeah, I mean, she did our laundry back when we were home. Now we got to do it ourselves, so if nothing else, that's why we miss her.
Diane wanted individual health insurance for her sons, but she needed something affordable.
Health insurance is important because all it would take was one accident, and I could lose everything I worked for.
So she did her research and called Georgiana at Capital Blue Cross.
Georgiana was great right from the beginning. She stepped me through the entire process, and the coverage is wonderful. They have a great plan, and it's affordable. I feel like I can sleep at night knowing that my boys are covered.
My mom will always be the smartest one.
Text radio to 74574 for a sample quote. Message and data rates may apply. Your final quote may vary. Please don't text and drive. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make it happen. Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com and how to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for
us. Thank you so much.
What's going on today, the big news?
Well, I think the big news is the president did visit Ground Zero. He also went to visit the firehouse. It's called the Pride of Midtown Firehouse. Lost 15 men on 9/11. The vice president was at the Pentagon. President came back to Washington, didn't say anything to us. We were actually watching the helicopter arrive today, but he didn't say much to us, just walked back right back to the Oval Office.
Well, he's got a busy week scheduled.
Tomorrow he's going to Fort Campbell in Kentucky. This is after he visits the Allison Transmission Plant, where he's going to be going with Secretary LaHood. He's going to be talking about creating jobs and oil prices. Then he is going on to Fort Campbell, and that is where the helicopters originated from in Kentucky.
So he's got himself a busy week. Some controversy over the killing of bin Laden. Well, there's a lot, but some angry folks.
There are some angry folks, and one of the people that is pretty angry is a guy by the name of Harlan Geronimo. Well, it turns out that there was a hearing today on Indian Affairs. It was previously scheduled, had nothing to do with the bin Laden situation. However, Harlan Geronimo is a lineal descendant of the Apache leader, and he said it was either an outrageous insult and mistake to slander Native Americans and its most famous leader in history. Geronimo, he said himself, was the focus of precisely such an operation by the U.S. military. And then he said that he had fought two tours of duty in Vietnam, and he was also the son of a World War II vet.
It shows how, you know, and I would think that most people don't even think about that. Because, you know, I remember as a kid, you know, you would jump off a cliff or you jump off of someone.
Right, and you say, Geronimo.
Yep, and you know, without even thinking.
Exactly.
So I wonder how much of it is that, or how much of it is was, you know, a conscious decision.
My guess is that it probably wasn't terribly conscious and nobody thought about it, but, you know, racism is unconscious too.
Yep.
Not necessarily conscious.
Absolutely. What else is going on?
Okay, well, the FCC chair was today before the House Judiciary Committee. He was talking about net neutrality. He said it's not regulation of the Internet. It's like a touch framework to preserve the dynamic, free, and open nature of the Internet. So he favors net neutrality. Also, the vice president had his debt conference today at the Blair House. The talks will resume on Tuesday. He said before that, before he said the debt ceiling is increase is going to be linked to spending cuts. He said it's not technically connected, but the face of the matter is practically and politically connected. And, of course, they've agreed on the number, but the question is what happens with that. And Speaker Boehner said that he agrees with aid to Pakistan, he thinks that there has to be some serious conversations about what happened, but that they have been very helpful in terrorism, and we should continue aid to them.
That's certainly not going to make the tea-twizzlers happy.
Oh, they're going to go out of their minds, that Boehner, and also Boehner said that he agrees with the president to not release the photo.
Uh-oh. Really not going to make the tea-twizzlers happy.
They're going to go nuts on the guy.
Yeah, I mean, because you got to feed their bloodthirst first, and then the other stuff.
Secretary Hillary Clinton was in Rome today, and very interesting there. Their U.S. is trying to free up $30 billion in assets that were frozen, and they want to help finance the opposition government operations for Libya. So far, the United States has given $53 million in humanitarian aid, $25 million in non-lethal equipment. She called removal of Gaddafi the best way to protect the Libyan people, and she called on governments around the world to isolate the Libyan regime.
There's a smart move, but do we know who the opposition is yet?
Well, there is this sort of parliament that they actually have. So they actually sort of formed a government.
Okay, well, do we know much about them? I mean, I haven't seen much about this on who these folks are.
We certainly know who a lot of the characters are, and they have been meeting with the European Union. We do know that.
And a foreclosure report out today?
Foreclosure report, yes. Conyers of Michigan, Congressman Conyers, as well as Senators Franken and Menendez, they released a GAO report saying that mortgage companies had been frequently signing foreclosure affidavits without personal knowledge of the cases. They're not supposed to do that. And they said the government oversight has been limited and fragmented. And they also are beginning to question how regulators and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was just set up, is going to share responsibility for oversight.
Well, it's nice that they've come to the party just a couple years late, I think. But it's nice that finally they've come around to it.
They have come around to it. And it looks like the Democrats are going to try and give the Republicans a run for their money on that.
Yeah, I sure hope so. Ellen Ratner, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. And now for what's going on here in Harrisburg. It appears that the governor has broken his no tax, no fee increase pledge. You know, I mean, if you remember during the campaign, he ran on not going to increase taxes, not going to increase fees. Yet five of his appointees to two state agencies voted earlier this week to sharply increase tolls on seven Delaware River bridges. The Associated Press is reporting that half of the 10-member board of the Delaware River Joint Toll Bridge Commission serves at Corbett's pleasure, and all five of Pennsylvania appointees who were put on the commission by Corbett, you know, they're saying, hey, you know, let's increase those tolls a little bit. Corbett's office on Monday did not provide any comment on Monday's vote, which seems to fly in the face of the Republican governor's opposition to the tax increases and fees. A commission spokesperson said that the decision is projected to increase annual revenues from $89 million to $113 million, or by about 27%. According to the AP, the new rate schedule will boost passenger vehicle tolls from 75 cents to a dollar when it takes effect July 1st. Truck tolls will rise by 75 cents per axle from $2.50 per axle to $3.25 for non-pickup two-axle trucks. You know, you look at these higher tolls and you're going, did they break the pledge? Kind of looks like it. He said no fees, no increase, nothing. Gonna all do it with cutting spending. Gonna cut that education down by $1 billion. We're gonna cut that higher education. We're gonna cut. I don't know if you've seen the story in Harrisburg here. Again, another one of these moments where you go, hold on a second, sounds too good to be true. But the AP is reporting that the mayor here has received a letter of intent from this guy named Jacob Friedman, who has said, you know what? We'll give you enough money. I'll give you enough money to get you out from underneath your massive debt. You just give me your incinerator and your parking garages for a long time. I guess, you know, the city is loaded down with more than $280 million worth of debt, which was borrowed in the last seven years. To overhaul the aging facility, and what's happened is they did it wrong to begin with, and then they had to go back, and it cost a boatload more money, and all of this stuff. And I think, you know, this may be one of those moments where the mayor goes, oh, okay, I'll take it. I hope not, because you're handing off your assets. But again, you know, it's the question of how are we going to deal with the crisis that we're in? Remember who put us in this. And I had a conversation with a guy today who is, and I'm not sure how I'm attacking this just yet, but he's, you know, the idea is he's going to be, he says he's a supporter of defined benefit pension plans, which most state workers have. And there's been this attempt to villainize people who have these defined benefits, which I think everyone should have. We really got screwed as a working class when they went to these 401ks. Another screw job for the American worker. But, you know, in having this conversation, and it's one of those where you go, you know, how can we talk together and how can we work through some things? My thought is that, you know, he's going to say, well, you know, we need more hybrids. We need more options. You know what more options does to a defined benefit plan? It destroys it, which is the point. And when a big moneyed interest throws money behind an issue, I think it's to destroy it. And the city's got some problems. The state has some problems. The answer is not chuck everything that works. The answer is not sell off all your assets at fire sale prices. That's not the answer. The answer is to do some sane, rational things, maybe increase revenue a little bit, maybe have those conversations. So as I was thinking about this whole defined benefit plan thing, along with our debt, you know, I was starting to think about the people who put us in this crisis. How did we get here? What brought us to this place? Was it irresponsible, greedy, evil thug unions who demanded too high of pension benefits? Or was it politicians who for themselves wanted nice pensions, but also didn't want to tell the taxpayers that they needed a little bit of money to pay for them? So all these years they kept pushing it down the road, hoping that they wouldn't have to deal with it. And then they went off into their sunset. And I've been thinking about the look, I'm... As like I think most people, I believe in shared sacrifice. When times are tough, we all have to chip in. We all have to chip in. So my thought is, and maybe you can help me because I'm thinking this through. We go back and we talk to every state legislator who has ever retired and is still alive and say, you know what, times are tough. Sorry, but you're going to have to lead by example. You are the ones who got us into this. You're the ones who said this was the right decision. You're the ones who led the way on this. So we need you to lead the way out of the crisis, which means we're going to go back retroactively into your pension funds, and we're going to cut 25% of your pension Because you know what? We need shared sacrifice. Shared, all of us. That means everybody. Not just the people who are working, not just the people who are down the road seeing their pensions destroyed, but everybody. Even the people who are, even those politicians who made the decisions, because the mess that we're in, this mess was caused by years of politicians saying, we're going to give these benefits because we're going to benefit from them, but we're not going to pay into the fund. We're not going to pay into the fund. We'll just keep pushing it down the road because the stock market is going to take care of it. We were projecting stock market gains forever, except we had that whole collapse. So I say the people who got us into this have to be the ones that lead us out. So before anyone tells me that, you know what, those state workers are going to need to, they're going to need to take a cut in their future pension, or we need to have a 401k only for future retirees, thus splitting the labor pool. I say we go back to the people who caused this mess and have them chip in first. You be the first. Which is my whole thing with the whole shared sacrifice. I don't have a problem with shared sacrifice. If you do the other things first, if you ask those who are doing very well to go first, that makes sense to me. You know, the Social Security thing they keep saying is broke. If it's broke, let's add a little revenue to it. See if that helps. Raise the cap. If that doesn't work, then we start talking about some cuts. But you raise the cap first. You ask those people who can conceivably help to do so. I had a friend of mine who, a real nice guy, who said, you know, early on he wanted to invest in the radio program, wanted to help us get off the ground. And I always felt bad because he said, here's a little help, a couple thousand dollars to push us in the right direction. And I said, well, there's nothing I can do for you. You don't advertise, none of that. He said, you know what, just the fact that you're pushing out there, that's what I need. And he had some advice. He said, you know, you got to ask people first. You got to give people the opportunity to say yes. So what I'm asking is the very wealthy to do a little more first. Lead the way. The Warren Buffetts of the world, lead the way. Instead of a $1 billion cut to education, 56% of higher education cut. And now we see this story from the Patriot that Harrisburg Area Community College, they're going to see their wages cut. Evidently, the raises they were going to get used to be 3%, now 2%, so they've cut them down. They say that's going to save them a couple hundred, $600,000. They're cutting a bunch of courses. They're taking more money back from the workers there in the way of higher health care premiums. And the line I love from the story, and let me just read the whole thing. It says, Hack has about 1,200 full-time and 1,200 part-time employees. Wages and benefits are by far the largest part of the college's budget, accounting for $111 million of the 2011-2012 school year. Unlike teachers in school districts who are facing pay freezes, the Hack faculty is not unionized, so the college can simply implement changes. I cannot believe the Patriot wrote that in there. I can't believe that they would write out and say, there you go. Because I don't think most people understand that. They can just do it at will. Because after all, Pennsylvania is an at-will state. The other part of this, how they're going to fix their budget fall, because they're about $3.3 million slat cuts that they're going to get from the governor, which is about 10% of their budget. Now the 14 state-owned universities, they're going to get whacked at 56%. The community college is just 10%. So they're going to whack the teachers, they're going to whack the professors, going to make them pay more. Why? Because they can. And then they're going to go after the tuition, and tuition is going to go up. What was it? It's going to go up from $106 a credit hour to $136.50 a credit hour. So $30 a credit hour, almost 30%, like 28% increase in tuition in one month. So you're going to see more debt, more kids struggling to pay for school, and you know what? More people not being able to go, more families not being able to afford, even community college now. What does that say about us? Anyway, let's take a quick break. We're right back to wrap things up.
Together. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began the first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized the renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. If you want to email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com, I do answer all emails. Personally, Dennis writes, Democrats have already sold out. The gang of six in the Senate have probably worked out a deal behind closed doors with the administration's approval. They'll cut programs even more, including Social Security, all in the interest of bipartisanship and shared pain. The issue, he writes, has always been who benefits from the deficit. He writes, deficits have been the norm in history. Deficits since 2001 have favored top incomes and corporations. And this is why we haven't had strong job growth. He says if we had deficits or fiscal policy that favors poor and working class families, we could reach full employment or near to. But this isn't what the plutocrats want. And I got to be honest, Dennis, I agree with you spot on. Here's the thing. Right when Obama came into office, the number one thing I called for was a public works program, the WPA style. And tomorrow is the anniversary of Roosevelt starting the WPA, and we're going to talk to someone from the Campaign for America's Future about that. But what we should have been doing is not saying, corporations, how can we give you more money to build up your business? We should have been saying, we need roads, we need bridges, we need solar panels for our state buildings, we need cars that get better efficiency. We shouldn't have given a whole boatload of money to the auto industry. We should have given them orders. We should have said, you know what? We'll give you some short-term loans, but you're going to build us 30,000 vehicles to replace the federal fleet, and they better get 40 miles to the gallon. You give them business. You purchase things. And that's what the government should have been doing, not all of these tax handouts, not all of these tax incentives for corporations to, oh, would you please create a job, please? We should have been saying, here's business. Who wants it? Who's going to compete for our contracts? Who's going to put solar panels on every house of people making under $30,000 a year? Who's going to put solar panels on every federal state building? Who's going to put solar panels on every school so that we can lower our dependence on foreign fuel oil? We didn't do that. See, because had you done that, you'd have had an industry explode. You'd had people to meet the demand, but we didn't do that. We chose the Republican route, which is to take care of the very wealthy and say, here, top 2%, please take our money, and oh, would you please trickle some of that down on us? Please? With the reality being, we're not getting trickled down, we're getting hosed. You know, the idea that we fill the rich folks' pockets so much that maybe something falls out and we can scramble over that has failed. Because their pockets never fill up. Their lust for greed never fills up. It's only human. We should have been creating customers. That's what we should have been doing. Thanks for the email, Dennis. I appreciate it. A couple of quick stories. Evidently, Carl Lewis can now run for state senate there in New Jersey. Originally he was banned by the Secretary of State there, but the court has now ruled that he can run, and he is going to run against this longtime Republican incumbent Dawn Addego in really a very heavily Republican area in southern New Jersey. So that'll be interesting to see what happens. Today in history also was the day that Ronald Reagan, today back in 1985, visited Bitburg, which really, really caught the ire of Holocaust survivors, because there were SS soldiers buried in Bitburg. He took a real beating over that, as well he probably should. But again, you know, it was one of those things that our media didn't really cover all that much. Also, two area businesses, Rite Aid and Hershey Corporation, they dropped in the Fortune 500. Rite Aid is now, I think, at 100 instead of 89, and Hershey is down around the 402 slot, so good for them. It would be nice if they brought some jobs back to the area. It'd be nice if we close that Mexican experiment and bring those jobs back here, so that Hershey can be the chocolate capital of the world, like I believe it should be. Again, all this outsourcing, all of this beggar thy neighbor economic development, at some point you've got to think that the adults in the room are going to take over, and at some point you're going to have to think that, you know, they're going to do the right thing. It just never seems to happen, man. It just never seems to happen. The Democratic Party has voted in Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She is now the head who has taken over for Kane, who's Tim Kaine, who's going to be running for the U.S. Senate there in Virginia to replace Jim Webb, which, you know, I think, I don't know. It looks like an even deal there, Webb for Kaine. Anyway, I want to thank everyone here tonight. Thank you, the listeners. Thank Brett, the guy who keeps everything sounding great. We'll see you back here tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's coming like the tide.
blood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the USP.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO.